Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
All around the world.
World nigga law.
In Australia, a landmark project is mapping historic massacres of indigenous people. So far, it has documented 250 sites across almost every state and territory. Fahana Darwood reports.
For hundreds of years, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have spoken about the mass murders of indigenous tribes. The historian Lyndall Ryan has embarked on a long, painstaking project creating an online map marking the massacres of Aboriginal clans during a period called the Frontier Wars between 1788 and 1930.
It's important to compile the map because we really don't know what happened in colonial Australia. This is all new information, and when you put all the dots on the map, they've accumulated to an extraordinary number. I come from a generation that knew very little about the frontier in Australia. I thought that Australia was peacefully settled, that there were very few massacres, and that, on the whole, Aboriginal people simply faded away. I think that my project is now showing that was not the case.
So far, Lyndall Ryan has plotted 250 sites across Australia, but it's thought the map will document double that number when it's completed. Details of who was killed, the approximate location of the conflict, and in some cases the motive and the perpetrators are included. Each marker on the map defines a massacre of six or more people and includes several deadly attacks on settlers committed by Aboriginal tribes. The number of Indigenous people killed is far greater than the number of settler deaths.
That was Fahana Darwood.
From Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Today marks the 51st anniversary of the 1967 uprising in Detroit, the rebellion or riot that left 43 people dead and thousands of buildings in the city destroyed. Michigan Radio did a deep dive into the history and legacy of that event last year, and you can find all of those stories by heading to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. This year, we focus on the smaller rebellion that started 2 days later in Grand Rapids. For an historical overview of what happened in Grand Rapids July 25th, 1967, we turn to Matthew Daly, Associate Professor of History at Grand Valley State University. Matthew, set the scene for us. What was life like if you were an African-American living in Grand Rapids in the 1960s?
The African-American community in Grand Rapids during the 1960s had grown dramatically in terms of size since before the Second World War. Yet it was still largely located in the southeast part of the city along Division Avenue and around Hall Street and the like. It's an area that was in many ways very segregated away from the rest of the city. It was kind of a city within a city. The growth of the community had come from the opportunity for new manufacturing positions. For a long time, the furniture industry in Grand Rapids had only really had a small black community working within it. But with the growth of auto parts and other sorts of industries, it drew a larger number of migrants from the south to the area, and also from Detroit. People moved around to different opportunities. General Motors had a large stamping plant along 36th Street. So it was a growing community, but it was still largely isolated. In many ways, there were only a limited number of opportunities for retail, for education, And that was a real point of contention. Paul Phillips, head of the Grand Rapids Urban League, a very significant figure in the city's history, had really sort of identified that all the way in the 1950s. And it was not really something that just sort of popped up overnight.
So take us to July 25th, 1967. What was the spark that set off these 3 days of disorder?
That's a really challenging sort of question. It depends on who you ask. There's several versions of what really got it started. The first is that there was a report of African-American youths breaking into a car and the police came. There was a scuffle and a young man fell and was injured, and therefore it drew a crowd. There's another that young men were throwing sort of rocks and stones at buildings and at white-owned businesses. There's another that there was a traffic stop. And really, at least for me, it's less that there was some sort of spectacular event that really started it. It triggered a response that people just got tired. This had gone on quite a bit. There had been a lot of tension within the community. There had been unhappiness with police and neighborhood relations. There had been an effort to start to address that. There had been a very strong sort of a real unease and a clear definition of real estate discrimination, not allowing African-Americans to move into different neighborhoods, that students were being steered. There was a discussion about desegregation of the schools that had the city pretty tense. There had been some resistance to doing so. There is also a recognition that there are limited retail and job opportunities, especially for young African-American men and women in the city, because this is the time that the mall sort of phenomena began, that neighborhoods began to lose their retail businesses. They would not hire African-Americans, or there were many stores that were being shuttered along Division Avenue. There was a full-scale transition, as in many places. And so all these things sort of feed together, and the police are the most visible part of city government in a sense that they're being hassled. Paul Phillips had warned against that sort of thing, that there was a real hostility. There was a lot of tinder lying around for that spark. It's during the time of the long, hot summers. There's a lot of unrest.
Particularly the headlines coming out of Detroit at about the same time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, everybody's on edge. This is the time when you've also got television that can tell people what's going on. You can see it with a lot of immediacy. And there's the people that come out. There's a series of fires that are started. There's arrests. There's a lot of property damage. In Grand Rapids, there's less looting. There's more property damage. That you really take it out on the businesses and the symbols that tell people that they don't have an opportunity, that there's schools that aren't really serving the community with a high-level education. There have been a lot of reports that outline that. The businesses that wouldn't hire African-Americans, businesses that were white-owned that wouldn't serve African-Americans or hire them. There's a lot of anger, and it runs the fire department ragged.
So the fire department is certainly busy putting out fires. Did we have National Guard brought in? I mean, in Detroit, the 101st Airborne wound up coming in. What about in Grand Rapids?
No, they did not come in with the National Guard. What ended up with it was about 220 some state troopers, other area local police departments. One of the things was that the city manager, Henry Neighbors, told the police chief, William Johnson, they said, don't mess around. They had to use a reasonable amount of force and not take any guff because this one's not going to get out of hand like Detroit. And the city had already sort of begun to think about that there was a real situation that could happen. I always sort of think it's sort of interesting that Detroit always is sort of portrayed as, oh, we didn't know it was going to happen, which is really not true. And it's really not true for Grand Rapids. People here, you know, in the city leadership knew that there was a lot of unrest. One of the big things that the city did that really sort of helped was that there had already been something called the task force. There was an outside consultancy that paired African-American community members with Grand Rapids police officers and sort of did role-playing and sort of relationship building. The police officers who were paired with the community members had visited the neighborhoods as civilians in civilian clothing, not as police officers, and sort of knew around. And the task force was deployed, and its members said that they did a lot of good, that they were able to head off a lot. In addition, there are a large number of injuries, but there's no deaths, amazingly. There's no sort of monumental events such as the Algiers Motel or other sorts of really brutal violence. There's a few reports of sniping. There's even questions that I've read whether or not they actually were sniping or people were just sort of imagining it. But it did not get nearly as out of hand, both between the efforts of, you know, community leaders, the police, and especially the community itself that did not come out and really sort of engage in that. The disturbance was under 1,000 people, and really a lot of people stayed in their homes, and in no small part because they knew the community members, that when these policemen arrived with these young men, they weren't viewed as sort of coming in as external force. They knew these people. They had a rapport. They were able to work with the community, and these young men could go out and really had that sort of trust and that credibility with the African-American community to help try to defuse that situation. The police officers themselves could speak to their colleagues and say, yeah, this isn't necessary. There's not a lot of sniping, and really keep the sort of out of control sense that it could really spiral into.
Over those 3 days, where in Grand Rapids did most of the disturbance happen?
Most of the disturbance is in the area along Division Avenue, around Hall Street, up to the north and the south. It's a very visible disturbance. It's in the sort of that large commercial district. It's a commercial backed up by residential areas. At that time, was a lot of transition in the retail area. And it's in the southeast part of the city, south of downtown. It's a relatively confined area. Unlike Detroit, where it spread very quickly throughout the city, in Grand Rapids, the police were able to close off the major arteries. They stopped the freeway and really took very proactive steps, both locally and at a distance. And with the task force, could really move into the area quickly with both what you would call overwhelming force, but not with overwhelming violence. It was a sense more of to try to keep people from wandering around, and if people would look outside, they would see the police. They would maybe be visited or stopped by a task force members who said, yeah, it's really not worth it, don't go out, to really calm things quickly.
What changed in Grand Rapids after this uprising?
It really started a series of discussions about what was going on. It forced the city's leadership, who had already been aware of it, to really try to wrestle with this more. It also engaged things such as the Model Cities Program from the federal government to begin to develop more African-American community leaders, that this was an issue that could not be ignored, that the white community was going to have to address it. In a very controversial move, it meant an effort at school desegregation, which led to the closure of the increasingly African-American majority South High School, which had been at that time the city's most diverse high school. That had some pretty mixed outcomes, you know, leading to some clashes between students at Union High School on the west side when there was integration. It was a really difficult set of discussions, but it also meant that community members were now increasingly listened to, for better, for worse. Did it solve all the problems? No, it unfortunately did not. But it also meant that it also didn't fester or get swept under the rug quite as easily as other cities who just sort of said, well, we don't really want to see this problem. Grand Rapids did try to take more steps to address it, some which were more successful, others which were not, or at least were very controversial and left some pretty unhappy feelings in the area.
When you look at Detroit, Matthew Daly, especially some of the areas where most of the violence during that uprising happened, it's an area of the city still struggling to move on 50 years later. How do you think that compares to Grand Rapids in 2018?
Very much like Detroit, there are many areas that are still struggling with issues of quality housing, for employment opportunities, for recreation. That remains a challenge. For Grand Rapids, there was generally, even though there was a lot of looting and fires, there was far less physical damage. So when you go to those neighborhoods, many of those buildings are still standing. Some of them are not being used, but others are being redone or try to be adapted. Grand Rapids has experienced a massive, real change in the city's fabric, especially in the downtown and the west side of the city, with issues of affordable housing and population demographic changes. Down Division Avenue, there are some changes that are going on as development spreads down from downtown to the north. And so there are still a lot of challenges, but in many areas, if you go through, these are places that have a great deal of potential. They still have vibrant communities. They have churches, strong community groups, strong organizations. And these are places that, while they face a great many challenges, are very interesting places. When I go there, they're always welcoming. They're eager to talk history. They engage. They work with my students very excitedly. They're happy to work with us, and I think that's really exciting.
Grand Valley State University historian Matthew Daly. Thanks so much, Matthew.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
Once a month, NPR and Kaiser Health News take a close look at medical bills that you send us. Today, we're going to hear about a young grad student who worked out a way to afford life-changing surgery, but not without a fight. Elizabeth Rosenthal, the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, is here to tell us more. Welcome.
Great to be here.
So this procedure that we're going to talk about is gender confirmation surgery. This is where a person surgically changes his or her external sex organs. And the story here is about someone going from male to female, right?
Right.
But it sounds like her medical bills tell a much larger story that a lot of us can relate to.
Sure. I mean, gender confirmation surgery is obviously very rare, but the kinds of billing problems Ren Vettens ran into are almost universal when you seek elective surgery in this country these days.
Okay, let's hear more about her experience. This is reporter Bram Sable-Smith.
Ren Vettens realized she wanted confirmation surgery the way a lot of 22-year-olds realize a lot of things.
I had been having an argument with my mom.
Okay, so her mom says it was not an argument. But they were talking about pronouns. Ren was raised male. In college, she began identifying as non-binary, using the gender-neutral they pronoun. Her mom was accepting, but from time to time she'd slip up. Ren would correct her, and this time it led to a discussion. Did Ren identify as female? Did Ren want to have surgery or take feminizing hormones?
And I said, no, 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 no. And then I immediately went upstairs and pulled up Google and started actually researching it and realized, oh, yeah, I want this.
Right around the same time, Ren was applying to PhD programs in theoretical physics. She had a few offers, but her mom, Kim Moreland, says one school stood out, the University of Wisconsin.
It's a great program, but they also were friendly to transgender students.
Graduate students at the university are covered by the state employee insurance. And in the summer of 2016, the board that oversees that insurance decided it needed to cover transgender health to comply with the Affordable Care Act.
Damn you, Obama.
Ren matriculated that fall, but soon after, Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker asked the insurance board to reconsider. And that December, they voted not to cover transgender care. The decision stung, but Ren realized there was another option. The school's undergraduate insurance explicitly covers confirmation surgery. Again, Kim Moreland.
It's a big print. It's right out there in the front. It says up to $25,000 for transgender surgery.
So Ren paid to switch to the undergraduate insurance, and she was one of the very first to get a surgery date at the University of Wisconsin Hospital, December 27, 2017. After 2 years of planning and many more years of gender dysphoria, Ren says it felt like a light at the end of a tunnel. And then?
And then in November, I got a call from the hospital saying that the bill they would submit to insurance was on the order of $100,000.
That would mean even with insurance, Ren would be on the hook for $75,000 for a surgery that typically only cost about $20,000. Ren's mother, Kim, is an OBGYN. She's got experience working with hospital billing departments and insurance companies. And she coached Ren to push back. Eventually, the hospital gave a new price, $20,000. But they'd have to pay it all out of pocket. That seemed reasonable. Ren's surgery was just weeks away, and they had to pay to keep the date. She figured she could deal with the money after. She called the hospital, credit card in hand.
She said, okay, give me the number. And I said, well, do you have like a written down bill of sale, what you're giving me when I give you this $20,000? She had no idea.
Eventually, she did get an itemized bill. She paid it, flew to Wisconsin, and Ren got the surgery. It was a success, and for Ren, a huge relief.
So in a ways, it was like being born again.
But then they got a bill. Kim Moreland.
The hospital wanted another $13,000.
The hospital had billed Ren's insurance $92,000 for the surgery. The insurance paid $26,000, and the hospital was billing Ren for some of the remainder, even though they had an itemized receipt saying they'd already paid.
They acknowledged that they'd already paid money, but they thought that was a down payment.
It was a mistake. Ren never had to pay it. But that mistaken bill gave Kim an idea.
I saw that and I thought, okay, now the insurance knows that we had surgery there.
Meaning the surgery was in the insurance system. So Kim helped Ren fill out an appeal, submitting a receipt for reimbursement. And a couple weeks later, a check arrived for $18,000. For NPR News, I'm Bram Sable-Smith in Wisconsin.
Okay, an $18,000 check. I mean, that sounds like good news, right?
Well, sure, but that check arrived only after a very long fight and after a journalist called the insurer asking about the reimbursement issue.
I guess we don't all have journalists fighting for us on our behalf.
Right. We need a system that works for everyone the first time around without all these hassles and interventions.
So what can we learn from Vettens' story?
Well, the big lesson is that there's no real price for anything in our system I mean, everything is the product of negotiation. I mean, remember, she got estimates that ranged from $19,000 to $100,000.
That's a crazy disparity.
Well, it's crazy. And if you're trying to figure out what you should pay, how can you even take the first steps with that kind of range, right? So what happened was the price estimates she got online were at the $19,000 end, and those are cash prices. So they didn't tell her much about what she, in fact, would owe. And in her case, the hospital charged her the insurance price, which was closer to the $100,000.
Why didn't the hospital charge her the out-of-pocket cash price?
Well, because the hospitals want to charge as much as they can, and they knew she had insurance, so they thought, well, we'll go with the $100,000, I assume.
So what did Vettins do? I mean, besides have a journalist ask a lot of questions on her behalf, what does it teach us about what other people can do about really high medical bills?
She did some really smart things. I mean, first of all, her mom was a physician, right? So she had someone in her corner arguing right, yeah. on her behalf. But also she enlisted the help of her surgeon. And your doctors are really on your side in this. And the hospitals need to listen to their staff surgeons. They're the ones who bring in the business. So her surgeon went to bat on her behalf as well.
And what other resources are out there?
There are a number of websites that will help you with estimating prices. There's Prater, there's Clear Health, there's Healthcare Blue Book. There are numerous ones. Those won't tell you the price you have to pay, but they'll give you kind of data points that you can use to argue your case.
This seems like so much work, so much research.
It's a really big burden to put on patients who are having surgery, especially something as emotional as gender confirmation surgery.
Right.
You know, you think about all the things that Wren Vettins' family did to help her. They went back and negotiated directly with the hospital, got an out-of-pocket cash price. Then they had to go back and negotiate with both the insurer and the hospital over yet another bill. And yet, in the end, it worked, right? So that's the good
news. In the very, very end.
Yeah, persistence is key, and be a fighter.
That's Elizabeth Rosenthal, the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That story you heard from Bram Sable-Smith is part of NPR's reporting partnership with Side Effects Public Media, station KBIA, and Kaiser Health News. And hey, if you have an interesting medical bill, we would love to see it. Go to NPR's Shots blog to share your bill with us and with Kaiser Health News.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
For decades, St. Louis's all-black Homer G. Phillips Hospital served as a beacon of achievement on the city's north side. It closed in 1979, but Dr. Earl U. Robinson, who trained there, kept the memory alive through a blog. Now with the help of his daughter and an old family friend, his stories have been brought to life in a new documentary, The Color of Medicine. Reporter Sarah Fentum talked to Robinson and his daughter, Becky Robinson Williams, about the film.
Homer G. Phillips was a employment opportunity for an area in St. Louis that was a very close-knit community called The Ville. And the community was surrounded by grocery stores, by cleaners, nurses, nurseries, churches, bars, the whole bit that makes the community vibrant.
It just seemed like it was a intricate part of his life, something really valuable. And I thought, you know, wow, there's so many other people that also train there. And they had stories as well. This is something that's a part of history that we can't let fade away. There has to be a way to preserve this.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of how the documentary was created? Because I understand it was kind of a family affair, right?
He came across the old family friend of ours, Joyce Fitzpatrick, and he mentioned that she had been doing some filmmaking, moved out to L.A. She was our neighbor. And matter of fact, Joyce Fitzpatrick used to babysit me. And I mean, it took months and months before we could even start planning how we were going to execute this film.
You know, a lot of parents have stories. But what was it about Homer G. Phillips that made you think it deserved this kind of treatment?
Well, you have to realize that a lot of the history in America around the Black rise has always been colored by what we had to go through. And very few times have we been able to use something of a positive nature to support the fact that we overcame, and that a hospital that was built especially for the black community, that was staffed by a totally black administration and employees, was able to achieve so much in the 21 years that it existed.
It seemed like St. Louis longed for someone to talk about their city in a positive way. You know, they just always had some kind of connection, and it was just people were coming out the woodworks of their, I guess, just their relationship with Homer G. Phillips.
And you both have seen the movie, correct?
Yes. The very first time my father and I saw the film was our first screening in St. Louis at the History Museum, Missouri History Museum. It was just an amazing, amazing experience. And what I'll never forget is when, you know, we were bringing my father into the museum, and my father's coming down the aisle, you know, we're trying to get him to the auditorium, and people are surrounding him and coming up to him and saying, Dr. Robinson or Earl or Robbie, you know, these people that are familiar with him. And just to see his face, because I don't think he knew how powerful this film was going to be for him, our family, the city of St. Louis. We were both just in awe.
This is a hospital that was all black. I mean, from the very lowest job to the medical director, everything was black. The mothership was Homer G. Phillips. To me, it is as beautiful as something like the Washington Monument or the Lincoln Memorial.
The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, it's, I mean, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
Well, in a new book, our next guest traces the history of the white power movement, which she says organized around a worldview of white supremacy, anti-communism, and apocalypse in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, and culminated in the 1995 bombing by Timothy McVeigh of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. Kathleen Ballou is an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago. Her new book is titled Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Congratulations on your book. Can you first comment on your thoughts on what Kristen Nielsen said, once again sort of reinforcing what Trump said a year ago, trying to take blame off of the white supremacists, and then put it into a broader historical context?
Yes. I should first mention that my research really goes only up to 1995 and the Oklahoma City bombing. And because I take an archival approach to this subject, I don't have the archives to fully explicate what's going on in the present moment. But I can say this. The archive shows us two important things about understanding the political context of Charlottesville and its aftermath. The first is that there are a lot of misconceptions about the white power movement, but we should understand it as a fundamentally violent movement that has always matched public activism, like we saw in Charlottesville, with violent underground activity. The second thing is that although it seems new to us to have a moment of sort of a wink and a nod of allowing this kind of activism in the public sphere, actually, it's not new. This is a movement that radicalized under the Reagan administration, turned violent against the state in 1983 at a moment of executive sort of executive acceptance. And because of that, this is we shouldn't think that the wink and the nod coming from the Trump administration might mean that these activists will be content with simply demonstrating in the public square.
Professor, I wanted to ask you, talk about this movement is really beginning to form and organize itself post-Vietnam. But how would you classify those right-wing or white supremacist movements that really developed in the 50s during the civil rights movement, all the bombings that occurred throughout the South? I'm thinking specifically in 62, the huge riot in Oxford, Mississippi, where there were actually pitched gun battles between federal marshals and white supremacists attempting to prevent James Meredith from entering Ole Miss. Could you talk about the relationship between that prior 50s movement to then what developed during the Vietnam War era?
Sure. What we see in the 1950s is the third era of the Ku Klux Klan. People think about the post-Civil War Klan, the 1920s, and then the 1950s. And it is classically organized in the way that many people understand Klan violence. The Third Klan is mostly in the South. It is mostly anti-Black. It is mostly oriented against what they see as the intrusion of the federal government into the battles against integration in the South. What I'm looking at is a more ideologically diverse movement in the 1980s that brought together people who had been in the Third Klan with a whole bunch of other people. So what I'm looking at is the unification of Klansmen, neo-Nazis, radical tax protesters, people who follow white supremacist theologies, and later skinheads into a cohesive movement organized around the story of the Vietnam War. The important thing about that organization is that it is it's different in character from the Third Klan in that it is organized through a model of leaderless resistance, meaning what we now think of as cell-style terrorism. The idea is that you can organize a smaller number of activists in cells such that they can't be infiltrated or effectively prosecuted.
And would the Bible of that then be the Turner Diaries? Or?
Yes, absolutely. The Turner Diaries is a utopian novel that's published in serial in 1974 and then comes out in paperback a few years later that lays out how a strategy like this could work to take on the highly militarized super state that is the United States in the late 1980s and 90s.
Professor Ballou, you write about this pivotal event in 1979, the shooting of communist protesters in Greensboro, North Carolina, the unified paramilitary and white power movement activists. Can you explain what happened then?
Yes, this is an event that happened in Greensboro in which a group of neo-Nazis and Klansmen came together under the name United Racist Front. Drove to an anti-Klan demonstration that had been organized by a leftist group and some other activists in the area and opened fire on protesters. They killed five people, four white men and one African-American woman. And even though this entire event was caught on multiple angles of news cameras who were on the scene, all of the gunmen were acquitted in state and federal trials, and a civil trial a few years later returned a decision that only one of the deaths had been wrongful. So the Greensboro massacre really gives us a historical cognate for Charlottesville in that we see unified group of neo-Nazis and Klansmen, and they are naming themselves as a unified movement, the United Racist Front. They're coming to a public altercation, and violence ensues in the confrontation. In the case of Greensboro, it also shows us a lot of things about how the American legal system was broadly unprepared to reckon with this kind of violence, because the gunmen were able to sort of effectively say that what they were doing was not racist, was anti-communist. The trials failed in part because of jury instructions that said to make conspiracy charges to deprive someone of their civil rights for reasons of race. That it didn't work out because they were able to say it wasn't about racism, it was about anti-communism. And this went as far as the defendants posing in front of the local Vietnam War Memorial to raise money for their defense. And the acquittals sort of gave the green light for further violence in this mode.
And the title of your book, Bring the War Home, why you chose it?
Sure. That actually comes from a essay from a collection written by Lewis Beam, who is a Vietnam veteran who served two tours as a Huey helicopter gunner and then returned home in 1968 and became a leader in this movement. And that essay, it's from an essay in a collection called Essays of a Klansman, which was published at the Aryan Nations compound in 1983 and then reissued in 1989. And in it, what Beam is talking about is the disconnect between the violence of warfare and the violence, or the violent experience of veterans when they come home. And his solution is to bring the violence of warfare into the domestic space. He says, Vietnam, bring it on home. He wants this violence directed against all of the people that he thinks betrayed him and fellow soldiers in the Vietnam War. And within this ideology, that includes everyone from the federal government to the sympathetic media, to others in the public sphere, to civilians who seem unaware of what has happened. Beam went on to organize paramilitary training camps for Klansmen, to be involved in the strategy of leaderless resistance, and to bring the entire movement online in early computer message boards called LibertyNet, and then to mastermind sort of further violence within the movement.
Before you move on, I did want to ask you very quickly about a very interesting chapter, Mercenaries and Paramilitary Praxis, about white supremacy and U.S. involvement in Latin America, particularly Central America and places like Nicaragua.
Yes. So one of the things that happens as people return from the Vietnam War is that some people choose to continue to use the skills they've learned for combat in other areas. There is a movement of mercenary soldiers to southern Africa, to Nicaragua and El Salvador, and occasionally to Honduras, in an effort to sort of undergird U.S. foreign policy in those areas. And for the white power movement, it's important because these sites become a place for people to sort of try out anti-democratic warfare before they bring those strategies home to the United States. It's also a corrective to the historical record that has sort of, well, and to public discourse, that has sort of thought about these movements usually as sort of armchair warriors going off to do cultural battle. And we see a lot of people think about, you know, paintball courses or Soldier of Fortune magazine as these harmless methods of American cultural entertainment in the 1980s. But for a lot of people, this was a real thing. This was real combat, and it should be treated as it does. It has a real body count.
Oliver North, now president of the NRA, responsible for getting weapons, selling weapons to Iran and using that money illegally to fund the Contras in Nicaragua.
Yes. And many white power activists spent some time in Central America before coming back to carry out white power activism in the United States. There's one case of an attempt to invade the island of Dominica in the Caribbean to set up a puppet government for the Klan and funnel the money back to the United States. That one, the people involved got caught quite early, but others did go to countries in Central America and Southern Africa to sort of practice guerrilla warfare methods before coming home. And we see this also in the Turner Diaries was sold in bookstores in South Africa, for instance. So it really, they really were overlapping sort of areas of engagement.
And we only have less than a minute left, but what's the economic program of this movement, as from what you can tell?
You know, it's interesting. This movement is usually thought of in pop culture as being a lower class movement or a southern movement or having something to do with backwardness. Actually, it's an incredibly broad movement. It's in every region of the country. It included men, women, and children, people with advanced degrees, as well as high school dropouts, religious leaders, as well as felons. I think what it shows us is that although this was a fringe movement, this really explains where overt racism went in a period that many Americans have thought of as colorblind on the right or as multicultural or post-racial on the left. Overt racism was part of our politics the entire time.
And Kathleen Ballou, what surprised you most in your research?
You know, I was really surprised by the role of women in this movement. Again, because we have these ideas of paramilitary culture as being hyper-masculine. Actually, women were doing an incredibly important job in this movement in interconnecting groups, in marriages that maintained group alliances, in recruitment,
and also in actual activism in their own right. Women worked disguising fellow members for violent action and may have even been involved in the writing of some key movement texts.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
And Kathleen Ballou, what surprised you most in your research?
You know, I was really surprised by the role of women in this movement. Again, because we have these ideas of paramilitary culture as being hyper-masculine. Actually, women were doing an incredibly important job in this movement in interconnecting groups, in marriages that maintained group alliances, in recruitment, and also in actual activism in their own right. Women worked disguising fellow members for violent action and may have even been involved in the writing of some key movement texts.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Kathleen Ballou's book is called Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement in Paramilitary America.
Yo, once upon a time up in Jersey, yo!
The problem of hateful speech, it turns out, is not limited to the internet. A pair of longtime New Jersey radio hosts were kicked off the air today after repeatedly referring to the country's first Sikh state attorney general as Turban Man on air. Amna Nawaz has the story.
New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy called the remarks by New Jersey's 101.5's Dennis Malloy and Judy Franco abhorrent and xenophobic. Here's what they said, referring to New Jersey Attorney General Gurbir Graywal on the Dennis and Judy show Wednesday afternoon.
The Attorney General, the guy, I'm never going to know his name. I'm just going to say the guy with the turban.
Okay.
The new Attorney General.
Turban Man.
Yeah, Turban Man. Hey, okay. Listen, and if that offends you, then don't wear the Turban Man. I'll remember your name. But Turban Man, is that highly offensive?
To me?
Yeah.
No. To people who wear turbans? Could be.
And New Jersey Attorney General Gurbir Graywal joins us now from Newark. Mr. Attorney General, thanks for making the time. I want to ask you, you've spoken before about experiencing discrimination at various points in your life. But in this one moment, when you heard these remarks, what went through your mind?
Amna, unfortunately, I have spoken on this issue before throughout my life, really. What was different about this particular incident is I think all of New Jersey heard it. More often than not, a lot of these comments are on the comment sections of newspaper articles or on social media. And when all of New Jersey heard it, my initial reaction was, you know, obviously, it was a little bit disturbing to me, but I've developed thick skin throughout my career.
Wait, bring it back.
I've developed thick skin throughout my career. I have a high-profile job. I have a lot of people around me to look out and protect me. I have a security detail. But what really bothered me was that there are so many other people in this state that don't have that same thick skin. There are people that don't have the benefit of the same security I have that will be affected really deeply by these types of comments, particularly kids, other sick kids who might not have thick skin.
Let me ask you about that position now, because it is very high profile. As you said, you are visible in many ways. You're also the first Sikh state attorney general in U.S. history. Do you see it as part of your responsibility to have to represent for your faith, to have to educate other people about your faith?
It's not just representing for my faith. I think it's standing up for those who can't stand up for themselves. You know, my faith is a personal matter, but by virtue of being a Sikh, it is something that I wear openly, and people know that I am a Sikh. And so I do explain myself, and I do explain to people the concepts of my religion. But it motivates me in a personal way, and it motivates me in a professional way to stand up for those who can't stand up for themselves. And so in a lot of ways, being a Sikh means to me being a natural-born public servant and standing up for, in the case of my work on behalf of DACA recipients, standing up against a DACA repeal, standing up against an unconstitutional travel ban, standing up against family separation, standing up against any sort of hate and bigotry that we see in this state.
Let me ask you about some of those positions you just mentioned, though. In your role as Attorney General, you have filed or joined more than 30 lawsuits specifically challenging Trump administration policies. Do you see it as part of your priorities in office to challenge this administration?
You know, I, as the chief law enforcement officer, I would love to concentrate all my time here on New Jersey. But unfortunately, New Jersey is also under attack from Washington. And so we have to stand up for the tens of thousands of DACA recipients in this state whose lives are being put in jeopardy. We have to stand up against the travel ban, which is affecting Muslim members of our of New Jersey, residents of New Jersey. We have to stand up on so many different issues because there's so much coming out of Washington at this point.
You mentioned standing up to the remarks you heard from the radio hosts earlier. You tweeted in response at the radio station and you said, this is my name, this is my position, I'm a sick American. You also said, I have three daughters. And yesterday, I told them to turn off the radio. What did you say to your children about what they had just heard?
Radio hosts are free to criticize me. I have an enormous privilege to serve the residents of this state, and they have the privilege to criticize me and call me out on policies that they don't like. But we could do it in a thoughtful manner. We could do it in a courteous manner and in a respectful manner. So that's what I teach my kids. And if I had the opportunity to talk to these radio hosts, that's what I would say to them. You know, people have said, would you go on their radio show? I have no desire to go practice my interview skills on a radio show. I think they could benefit by joining me in a community meeting where I go talk to residents in this state who have been affected by hate and bias crimes. And I'd welcome the opportunity to show them how hateful conduct or hateful comments are now turning into hateful conduct in parts of this state and how we all have a responsibility in this moment to act better. And that's the message I sent to my daughters. That's the message I tried to portray through my work. And that's a message I'll continue to stand up for as Attorney General of New Jersey.
New Jersey's Attorney General Gurbir Graywal, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It was a white man up in Georgetown here in Washington. And everybody knew him. They called him the Wolf Man because he wore a long beard and long, scraggy hair. And he was out on the street. I mean, cold weather. He barely had enough clothes, I mean, to cover him. Sleeping on park benches. So some people who worked at some of the office buildings around there, including some black people, they went out there and started leaving him food and all like that, trying to help him. And one summer day, some interviewer sat down next to him and asked about him. Said, where'd you come from, you know? Said, they call you the Wolf Man. You've been around here for years and whatnot. Said, what happened to you? Said, you know, maybe we can help you. You get on your feet and whatnot. I mean, you seem to have a little bit of sense and whatnot and all like that. He said, I don't need any help. He said, people come and leave stuff here and all like that. He said, I really don't need it. He said, I got folks that got plenty of money. Been trying to get me to come stay with them and all like that. I don't want to go. I don't like them. Now, how many black people can say that who are out here on a park bench? See what I mean?
If you walk into any homeless shelter in Washington State, you might notice something. You're likely to see more African Americans than you see out in the wider community. That's because African Americans are vastly overrepresented in the homeless population, both here and across the country. It's a mystery that's confounded researchers for years. The numbers don't make sense, even if you account for higher poverty rates among African Americans. You're listening to KNKX, and this is a pattern 88.5's Will James has also seen in his reporting on homelessness. He brings us a story about efforts to untangle the complex relationships between race and losing a home.
If you ask Marquise McCrary how he ended up spending so much of his early 20s living in shelters and sleeping on buses, he'll tell you a story. They say Papa was a rugged star. It starts in Fort Worth, Texas, where he was just building up a following as a rapper when his mom lost their apartment.
It was new management, and she couldn't keep up with the rent, and we got evicted.
So he moved to Washington State to live with his brother, who then fell into financial trouble himself and had to move, leaving McCrary in Tacoma without a place to live.
It can feel like a curse sometimes. Sometimes I feel like you're the person who's meant to deal with it all.
He'll tell you about the time he had a job and got an apartment through a housing program and then lost it all after the death of a close uncle sent him into a spiral of depression. And he'll tell you about how, before any of that, he spent so much time helping his single mom raise his four brothers and sisters, he never really learned the skills he needed to survive.
It's like, is it family? Is it you? Is it just the things you don't know?
It's basically a story of individual missteps and misfortunes that left him wondering why all this was happening to him.
It's like this fear of life that it's not being nice to you at the moment. You know, just give me a break for a second.
But if you talk to researcher Mark Dones, you'll hear a bigger story.
These are folks who have been caught up inside structures that are hundreds of years old.
It's a story of how McCrary's race affects his life in all sorts of invisible ways that make him more likely to fall into homelessness. Dones, who uses they-them pronouns, worked for a Boston-based nonprofit called the Center for Social Innovation and spent more than a year on research aimed at unraveling the mystery of why so many African Americans end up homeless. Dones says the mystery was something everyone knew about, but no one had really dug into.
Folks of color, historically marginalized folks, are not the topics of research.
So the mystery lingered. Here it is. The population living under the poverty line is mostly white, even those in deep poverty. But if you look at the numbers, it's almost like there's a force protecting poor white people from becoming homeless, or something making poor black people more vulnerable to it. The result is African Americans are 12% of the U.S. population, but an estimated 40% of the homeless population.
Between deep poverty and homelessness, there's a factor, right? Something is happening in that space that is applying disproportionate pressure on folks of color, and it is not simple enough to say that poverty is the core driver of homelessness.
Dones and their team combed through data on homelessness from six communities across the country, including Tacoma and Pierce County, and they interviewed dozens of African Americans experiencing homelessness in those communities. People with stories like this one from Pierce County.
We stayed at my grandma's house, and it was like nine people in a two-bedroom. So we did that for a few years. But long story short, I just felt like I just didn't want to just live off my family, knowing they don't have nothing.
I started to hear this story over and over and over again. And
it's a story of different crises, even relatively minor ones, sending African Americans spiraling into homelessness and feeling like they have no one to turn to for help. One day, Doan scribbled two words on a legal pad.
Network impoverishment.
Network impoverishment. It's what Doan calls their theory of why more African Americans end up homeless. It goes like this. If you're poor and white and get into trouble, chances are you know at least one person who can bail you out, a family member or a friend, someone who can lend you a few hundred dollars if your car breaks down and you need to get to work. But if you're black, it's more likely you don't know a single person with the extra cash to get you through an emergency. So that broken down car might cost you a job, and that might set you behind on rent. And still, there's no one with enough resources to bail you out. In other words, it's not just that you're poor, it's that everyone you know is poor too. Doan says even if poor African Americans and white people live equally close to the edge of a crisis, it might be that African Americans have less of a buffer to keep them from falling off.
The network itself, because of this like total lack of flexible capital, functions in a fragile and an impoverished state.
And because black communities are more fragile, it takes less for black individuals to lose their homes. In fact, Dones' data appear to show African Americans enter homelessness with higher incomes and lower rates of mental illness and drug abuse than white people.
It seems like folks of color who are experiencing homelessness are generally better off by almost every indicator than their white counterparts.
Almost as if more has to go wrong in a white person's life for them to become homeless. Dones believes network impoverishment in African American communities is behind these trends. But what's behind network impoverishment? Doan says that's where a more familiar story of institutional racism comes in. Generations of policies that locked black families out of chances to buy homes and build up wealth.
We disenfranchised folks of color from participating in the housing market until like 1968. So, you know, we have in a lot of ways created races of renters and races of or race, right, of property owners.
Everyone knew that history was there. But Dones feels they now have a clearer picture of how that history plays out in people's modern-day lives. This is just one theory that might explain the high numbers of African Americans who become homeless. But for some of the people trying to solve homelessness, it's already changing the way they approach their work. Tess Colby oversees Pierce County's homelessness programs. She handed over years of county data for Dones to analyze. She says it's not like people in her field were race blind. more like race unconscious.
I think it is impossible not to see the disproportionality in your client base. But I don't think that there was a lot of conscious attention paid to it in a way that moved the conversation away from simply acknowledging and bemoaning the fact to, well, what are the solutions?
Those solutions aren't clear at all. But Colby says Doan's research has people like her thinking about them.
All of the hundreds of years of racist laws and racist policies, overcoming that is daunting. What I feel like is we as a county can have a more nuanced response as a result of being a part of this project. And that's what I'm excited about.
For McCrary, overcoming that daunting history has become the focus of his life. He's got a job as a security guard at Tacoma's baseball stadium. He's made some friends who are letting him stay with them, and he's saving up money to go back to community college. But that idea, network impoverishment, it's all too familiar to him. He says he knows what it's like to not have family to fall back on.
It's just one of those things that you just kind of know about your family. You know your limits of your family and stuff like that. So with mine, it was more like we were all kind of figuring things out ourselves. You know, we don't have that one family member who just, not necessarily, you know, the key holder to certain things that we need, but it's just we don't have that.
He says his mom and siblings are once again at risk of falling into homelessness back in Texas. He says his goal is to become that one family member who can stop that from happening. Will James, 88.5 News.
I'm sorry.
You want to let me how much of a I am?
Yeah, I want to let you personally know.
Tonight, a road rage confrontation erupts to racial slurs, and it's all captured on video. Good evening. Thank you for staying with us at 6. I'm Mike Jackson.
I'm Colleen Marshall. On the video, you can hear a contractor calling a black man the N-word multiple times from a company truck. That video was sent to our newsroom.
NBC4's Rob Sneed joins us with the video. It's all new tonight at 6. Rob?
The man who sent us the video called police. He said he felt he was in danger. Tonight I had the chance to speak with both men involved.
Okay, how can I help you?
I just want to let you know what a
you said what?
I want to let you know what a
you want to let me how much of a I am?
Yeah, I want to let you personally know how much of a
no, I never would have expected it to happen to me, but the world we live in nowadays.
All of this, Charles Lovett says, started with a misunderstanding near Morse Road in 71.
He was trying to cross the double side. The solid white line that you're not supposed to. I continued on and he got behind me. Didn't know that he was really following me home until I got in my driveway and I looked back and I see the van that almost hit me sitting at my driveway.
NBC4 went to the listed address of the business on the side of the truck. For now, we have chosen to blur out the name because charges haven't been filed against the driver of the van. Our crews caught up with him.
I didn't follow him home, and the way I confronted him as, hey, listen, you cut me off.
So you knew where he lived before, is that what you're saying?
No, I didn't say that.
Get to his home then, if you didn't follow him home.
How many times have you followed a car? How many times have you been followed? You think someone's following you, and they're going to someone's house down the street. It's just coincidence.
This man would not give his name, but he admitted to calling Lovett the N-word, and he says he has no regrets.
Well, I don't know if it makes it right or wrong, but all I can tell you is I grew up with it, and it's not a big deal for me.
It was a big deal for the man who contacted us.
It was for him. It was a big deal for me to get cut off for no reason. Okay.
People are going to be watching this tonight. They're going to see this tonight. So you have no apologies. You have nothing to say in terms of regretting what you said. You don't regret it.
Not whatsoever. None.
You could say anything to this man.
I don't have anything to say to him.
I also called the number listed for the business in an attempt to speak with the owner, and no one has called me back. Local for you, Rob Sneed, NBC4.
This is my rifle. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am.
I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
He would help anybody for anything.
Those are the memories Pearl Awise is left with after her son, 25-year-old Chad Merrill, was murdered early Saturday morning at Red Rose Restaurant and Lounge in York County. Awise says her son died trying to help someone he knew.
This guy came over and started making racial slurs, and Chad told the guy he was talking to just to ignore him that he was drunk.
Police say after reviewing surveillance video, they saw 24-year-old James Saylor, who was allegedly making racial slurs earlier that night, shooting toward the building from inside of his truck. In the video, police say Merrill is seen walking out, approaching Saylor's vehicle.
And then he just lifted his arm and shot him in the chest. And that poor boy is so skinny, it went right through. He didn't have a chance. The detective said, he said, I'm sorry to say it, he goes, but he didn't know what was coming, so there was no pain.
Merrill was taken to York Hospital, where he died 1 hour later.
They just put us in a room and locked the door and said somebody be in, but I knew it was too late then, because usually that's what they do until they come and tell you.
We reached out to the owners at Red Rose Restaurant and Lounge regarding the incident. However, they declined to speak on camera. Awise says she wants Merrill to be remembered as a loving son, dedicated father to his four-month-old baby boy, and caring friend.
He used to tell me in the mornings, he'd get up and say, Mom, he had me up all night. He goes, but you know what? He goes, I can't yell at him because he's too darn cute. But you can't take life for granted. I mean, you just don't know. I just seen him last night. He walked out my door at 10 o'clock and said, Mom, I love you and I'll see you later.
Saylor was arrested and is charged with one count of criminal homicide. He is being held at York County Prison with no bail. Police are still trying to figure out if Merrill was targeted because of Saylor's earlier racial slurs or if he was confronting Saylor. The investigation is still underway, and anyone with information is asked to contact Hellam Township Police.
Sanford Police Department, line is being recorded. Sean.
Hey, we've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. It's Retrieview Circle. The best address I can give you is 111 Retrieview Circle. This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about.
Okay, and this guy, is he white, black, or Hispanic?
He looks black.
Did you see what he was wearing?
Yeah, a dark hoodie, like a gray hoodie. These assholes, they always get away.
An argument over a convenience store parking spot ended with a man dead, but there will be no charges because the guy who shot him was, according to the police, simply standing his ground. Now, we're going to show you some of the video, the surveillance video. And what you're going to see is Marcaeus McLaughlin. He exits the convenience store, approaches Michael Draca, pushes him, and then begins to, he walks a little bit back. Draca pulls out a gun and shoots him in the chest. Draca flees to the convenience store and later on dies. And the police see that and think he was completely justified in shooting that man dead.
So they had an argument, and apparently this Draca guy often has arguments over parking spots. One of the reasons that Marcaeus was so upset was because his kids were there. His five-year-old was there, and this guy's being belligerent. There's two more kids in the car along with his partner. And so he got upset, and he pushed him. And he pushed him hard. You saw that in the video. Anybody think that guy's life was in danger? He's walking away. Marcaeus was walking away. And he shot him anyway, killed him. And in Florida, Marcaeus does not have the right to stand his ground because he doesn't have a weapon. But if you have a gun, you could stand your ground. By definition, stand your ground is not self-defense. You could just use self-defense if your life is in actual danger. What stand your ground says is, if I am in any way, shape, or form attacked, and I feel like my safety is in danger, I do not have to retreat.
Yeah.
I could just murder the guy, and the state will say, you're free to go. And that's what they did. That guy's free. Shot him in cold blood. Killed him.
That is what the law is there for. It is to legalize murder. So people who have wanted to kill someone can carry a gun around, and if they get lucky, the justification will present itself to them. Nobody can look at that video and think that his life was in danger. And I'm going to go farther. He did not think his life was in danger. He didn't pull out that gun and then think, oh, this guy's still going to come at me without gun pointed at his chest. Nobody actually thinks that.
At a bare minimum, John is right. He could have said, freeze. He could have said, don't come near me. I have a gun. He could have pointed the gun and not shot it. He chose to murder that guy because he walks around with a gun and can't wait to use it. And the cops let him go. There's no justice in this country.
And some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Yeah. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers?
A new call to action tonight in the murder of Oakland teenager Nia Wilson on a BART platform. Nightbeat's Chris Nares on what community groups are now demanding from investigators.
2 days after 27-year-old John Cowell was charged with first-degree murder in the stabbing of Nia Wilson, a call for an even tougher charge.
We're asking that the prosecutor consider hate crime charges.
A coalition of faith leaders and an Oakland City Council member say the community is convinced that the murder of Nia Wilson was not random, but an act of hate.
Well, I think the community is very concerned that somehow in the prosecution of this crime that we would not see equal justice and that Nia's life would be cheapened.
Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley told reporters this week she's looking at all angles, but so far there is no evidence of a hate crime.
We're still gathering evidence to look at that, and we always have the opportunity, if we find evidence that can prove the hate crime allegation, then we'll amend the complaint.
But these leaders point to new numbers from the Attorney General's office showing hate crimes are up in California, 17% over last year. And Alameda County saw the highest increase in hate crimes in the Bay Area.
It would be, I think, for the prosecutor to prove that there wasn't a race element related to this violence.
Even with no hard proof of a hate crime, they point to a justice system that they say has disproportionately impacted people of color throughout history.
Unfortunately, we cannot declare that we have the greatest of trust in systems of government that are given the responsibility to drive the prosecution of those that have slain persons in our community.
In Oakland, Kristen Ayers on the Night Beat.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 28th, 2018. So I have been told. The segment that we concluded with, Nia Wilson's family, friends, victims of racism who were just concerned about Nia Wilson, black female, 18 years old, killed, victim of a white terrorist attack in East Bay, California. Pause for Oscar Grant, since we're talking about blacks being murdered at the BART station. When he said the concerns that the black community have about Nia Wilson's life being cheated, this here is our compensatory call-in. We are supposed to be mindful about words. That word community, bring it up regularly. It is invoked regularly. Part of eradicating confusion is using correct terms. I submit pretty confidently, if black people had a community in Oakland, California, Seattle, Washington, anywhere in the world, we would not have these problems. We would not be making requests that the murderer of Nia Wilson be charged with a hate crime, whatever that means. We would not be submitting these requests if we had a community. The system of white supremacy completely voids the idea of a community for black people. And again, I think we would start to loosen, or we would start to eliminate some of our confusion if we would stop using incorrect terms when describing our problems, suggestions for solving these problems. You cannot have a community and be subject to a system of white supremacy. That is very, very important. When you have expectations that you are in a community, you are going to be set up for frustration and confusion on a constant basis. We're not in a community. We're on a plantation. White supremacy. This here is the compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have comments, thoughts, suggestions. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A few things before we get to folks who dialed in. First and foremost, the context of white supremacy is listener supported. If you think the program is constructive, you can invest. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Enormous thanks to all of the investors, listeners for the past decade who have supported the context of white supremacy. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also support by hitting my wish list at Amazon.com. It is listed under Gus T. Renegade. Again, tremendous appreciation to all the folks for 10 years, basically, who have nabbed items from the wish list. It has been super appreciative. Again, I hope the cows has helped black people, non-white listeners, get an accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is, how it works, suggestions for how we can eliminate this problem promptly. Other things to make sure I share before we proceed. There were issues with the archives. They had not been updating at iTunes for, I think, at least 2 weeks or so. I had talked about it previously, but that problem has been corrected. The archives should be current at Black Talk Radio Network. iTunes, Mr. Fox has continued with outstanding investment of his time and energy in uploading content at YouTube from the context of white supremacy. I think he's current as well. So there are lots of different ways that you can access the programs. Again, I think some of the old, like years back, 4, 5, 6 years back, some of the older iTunes archives, I am having to go through and manually correct those. And I mean, we're talking lots of content, so that will take some time. But other more recent episodes, segments should be available with no problem. You can drop me an email if you have any issues. Next, go ahead and get the yoga aspect of the program out of the way now. So after we concluded tearfully our last segment on Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man yesterday, Gus T. trotted off to teacher training. We discussed book we were supposed to read, or a book we've been reading throughout the training session, Michael Stone, Suspected Race Soldier, The Inner Tradition of Yoga. Now, I saw this book. Thankfully, an investor, speaking of wish list, nabbed it for me. I requested used, cheapest copy of the text. I did not want to buy a book written by a white person. I didn't want anyone to support or invest in this book written by this suspected race soldier. But I'm trying to get my, you know, certification, get through the course. So we have to read, like, I think a total, we don't have to read the whole book. I think they assign like 6 chapters. So some aspects of it is just kind of going over some basic yoga fundamentals. Other aspects of it, he's talking about, you know, we're all connected. And I mean, just the fact it's got his face on the cover, that alone is enough for me to be like, I have no interest in reading this. This is someone that I suspect of being a racist and a hypocrite. You're not going to talk to me about spiritual enlightenment through yoga. And just, I have been super saturated with whites at my yoga practice, tubby white chick included. I really would enjoy at this point reading and getting like yoga philosophy from non-white practitioners. That is what I would really enjoy. So, you know, I go through, I read, I'm not impressed. Some of it makes absolutely no sense at all, especially when a white person starts talking about how you deal with suffering. Like, oh, I'm totally repulsed. So yesterday is the class we're supposed to talk about all of this. So we get there, and the other black female, only other black person in training, she's not present. So it's all whites, myself, non-white instructor. He self-identified as non-white, non-black, non-white. So we're having this discussion, and the bulk of the students look uninterested, uninspired. I can't say that this is like the most comprehensive, well put together discussion that I have ever seen. Like, the instructor is kind of stumbling through some aspects of it. I mean, it's not anything to change my opinion of this being rubbish. It's written by a suspected racist, and, you know, let's just move on. So we get to one point in the discussion. White man, suspected racist, raises his hand, asks a question. He says, what was the process of selecting this book? So somehow we end up veering to other aspects of the discussion. We talk for 20 minutes, comes to me, and I say, so back to, how was this book chosen? And so the instructor, again, non-white, non-black male, he says, well, the corporate office selected this book. Nobody at the studio picked this book. The corporate office said, this is the book that we're going to read. And, you know, we just follow orders. And I don't know what their process was for picking this book. Truthful answer, I think. Okay. So the white man that raised that question originally, at this point, he speaks up and he says, okay, I wanted to know that. He said, reading this book, you know, I looked and did some research on the author, intelligent. And he said, this author died in 2017. So I said, wow, that's so recent. I went and I looked. This white man that we're reading about spiritual enlightenment and how you're supposed to use yoga to remember that we're all connected and we're all attached to get out of this suffering, when you start thinking of I and me, myself, and I, and what I want and what I don't like, to get out of all that. You know, we're all connected in all of this, and get away from your attachments. This white man who wrote a whole book filled with this malarkey that we were required to read and purchase and all of that, died from a heroin overdose in 2017. Gus T did not know that tidbit of information. Not that it was needed. I'd already come to a conclusion about what I thought about the book, but oh man. Woo! Apparently, several other white students in the class, they did know that bit of information. And at that point, they spoke up as, to, yes, I also knew that. And I thought about that as we were reading through the book, and took away some of my motivation or zest for reading the material. And that kind of recalibrated the whole discussion. But I mean, why, I thought of Red in Nevada and whites and what they call opioid difficulties. But I mean, wow, this is supposed. Anyway, that was yesterday at yoga teacher training. More than halfway through, give me my certificate. And next, the segment where they were talking about confirmation surgery. No one is better with words. I started this broadcast giving my thoughts again on community. That's something Mr. Fuller's been talking about for years. The late Dick Gregory talked about for years. So many folks, Dr. Welsing, you cannot have a community. So-called Jews, Nazi Germany, that is not a community if you are in a concentration camp. Words are extremely important. No one does it better currently, 2018, July 28th. No one does it better than whites. confirmation surgery? Are you serious? What exactly is being confirmed? Who came up with that terminology? When was that phrase first put into use? Like, they have etymology dictionaries and books where you can go and track all of that information. Confirmation surgery, like the way the legitimacy, the validity that is conveyed just by the use of a term like that. Confirmation surgery. So in that segment where they're talking about Ren Vettens, I think that's how you say his name, suspected racist, and they're talking about the pronoun words, pronouns. He has this discussion with his mom about what he wants to be called, and then he goes and does his research. He's going to do the confirmation surgery in that segment on this here broadcast, exclusively on the compensatory call-in. I say, no metaphors. Be mindful about what we say. Frequently, metaphors are used to cause a lot of confusion and to enforce the system of white supremacy. Those metaphors frequently are conveying white supremacist concepts. In that segment, Ren Vettens, with his confirmation surgery, he said after he got the surgery, he felt like he was born again. Are we talking about Jesus? Is Ren Vettens, has he become Jesus because he got his penis snipped or whatever happens in confirmation surgery? You are now Jesus? Wow. The metaphors. He says when he was en route to get the surgery, that it was like a light at the end of the tunnel. Always when something good happens, you're going away from darkness. Metaphors consistently. It came up the report. The attorney general in New Jersey, Gerber Gruwall, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. I'm a victim of white supremacy, greatly retarded. But where the whites got on the radio, I remember Opie and Andy. I almost played that segment. I know we have some listeners have got to remember Opie and Andy. Whites have tons of these radio stations. I think Puff for years has talked about you can listen to any of these anywhere you happen to be. Just check out your local white supremacist broadcast where you have folks like what you heard in New Jersey talking like this on a regular basis. The callers will call in and they're not no good Obama. They had 8 years of that when the Obamas were camped out in Washington, D.C. But Mr. or Attorney General Gruwall, in that segment where he was talking about these race soldiers who were calling him Turban Man on the air, and I'm sure they'll be back on Don Imus. I'm sure they'll get a new segment and probably even more money. But he said that he had thick skin. That was one I did a rewind on. What does that mean? I have thick skin as a result of being a victim of white supremacy. I'm paraphrasing what he said because he just talked. He followed that up by talking about how he had been mistreated because he's classified as non-white. No idea what that means. I think we should be exact in discussing, particularly if we're discussing how we have been terrorized. Man, let's try to be as specific, as exact as possible. And I just don't know what that means. I do not have, quote unquote, thick skin. That almost suggests that I can take punishment, that I have become somehow less sensitive to punishment. And I know for me, that is not the case. I am very aware when I'm being mistreated, and just because I have been subjected to a lot of mistreatment, that does not make it any less difficult or does not make me any less alert to the fact that I'm being mistreated. But again, that is a metaphor. Maybe I'm not processing what it's supposed to convey correctly. The segment, this even is giving me a rewind. My memory is not as good as it used to be. This because of the system of white supremacy. There was a few weeks back, there was a segment talking about white terrorism in Oregon, right down the road from Gus T. They were talking about how they had a program and they were trying to compensate black people financially to move back, since the state of Oregon had made it like an official part of their state policy to exclude Negroes. So in that segment, they were talking about how pitiful this program was doing, how they had brought back maybe, you know, two Negroes in the time that they've had this program. And, you know, it's just been terrible. And I inserted a laugh track in there as they were talking about how pitiful the program is, because anytime whites start talking about, all right, we are going to roll up our sleeves and we are going to work hard and get this racism problem licked. We are going to get, you know, you niggers got lots of problems. We got your back. We are going to get some problems solved. And then it never happens. I inserted the laugh track because that's what I expect. That's just giggles to me when whites in Portland or anywhere else in the world are talking about, man, we got our program together. We're going to bring our niggers into town and it's been going and everything. And I don't know, somehow we've only got two niggers. Just hasn't matured, but we're going to keep working. We're going to keep working. Don't you worry. All of that is giggles to me. So when they had that segment up the road now in Seattle, Washington, where Gus T is, and they're talking about homeless black people, and they don't know why the specific verbiage that they used, this mystery has confounded us for years. Like, come on. Neely Fuller Jr., a victim of white supremacy who has for decades conceded and announced without shame that he has been greatly retarded by the system of white supremacy, as have I, succinctly wrapped that up in about 30 seconds as to the mystery of why niggers are homeless. I mean, whites practice white supremacy. That's how that needs to be processed, in my view. You are not talking about anything new. White people are not ignorant about this process, and they waste a lot of time and energy giving reports like that. Man, it's just amazing. What a mystery. How is this happening? This nigger was sitting on the bench last year and still sitting here this year. What could it possibly explain this? They do this sort of thing all the time. It causes confusion for non-white people. That sort of thing should be, interrupt, get to that like quick, like in the first 30 seconds. We want the niggers to be out homeless. It's not even but five niggers in the state, or I won't say five, but there are very few black people in Washington. This is announced. Whites almost brag about this on a regular basis. You know exactly why you could have so few black people in the state of Washington, and the few that are here are sleeping out under a bridge. That's what we want in the system of white supremacy. Just make that succinct. Don't waste time and money acting like, oh man, this is a problem and we don't know what's happening. And the other important way that they practice white supremacy racism in segments like that, they had a lot of accurate information about, oh yeah, we had redlining. We had all these restrictive covenants that would not allow black people to rent or own property. And they're absolutely right. We've talked about that accurate information. However, they do a really skillful job in making that seem like all of the white supremacy that was practiced against these niggers that has resulted in all this nigger homelessness were policies and things that were done by racists like 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 100 years ago. No, there are things that whites are doing right now, again, July 28th, 2018, right now at this very moment to make sure that the Negroes will be homeless tomorrow, next year, 500 years from now. That's what white supremacy racism is, not all of this, oh my gosh, what is this? And we need to go and study and see if we can figure out Negro homelessness in... Next up... In that same segment, and again, getting back to terms are supposed to be very important. That's one of the points of emphasis for this program specifically, compensatory calling. In that same segment, discussing homelessness, they talked about the fragility of the quote-unquote black community, that word again. Anytime I hear that word, I think of, in my view, it's not a suspect, but I'm just doing it not to name called, suspected race soldier Robin DiAngelo, who I did ask to be a guest on this program. She practiced racism in declining, and she wasted some of my time. How can black communities, quote unquote, be fragile? And then you have a concept being promoted, white fragility. It can't be both in a system of white supremacy. If you've got white power, then you can't have white fragility. If black people are fragile and homeless, that's because of white power, white terrorism. Use correct concept. Whites are phenomenal. No one does it better at using words to maintain confusion. One of the primary mandatory products of racism, white supremacy, really one of the things that allows the system to remain in place, non-white people being confused about racism. And a lot of that comes down to terms. Whites deliberately using incorrect terms and encouraging non-white people to use or to continue using incorrect terms to describe, articulate racism, white supremacy. With that, I will say it again for this broadcast specifically. If we could not use metaphors, I would be extra appreciative. As I've stated, whites, master deceivers, a major component of that is using similes, like I was born again. That's what he said. Using similes, analogies, metaphors to spread confusion. They will present two concepts and insist that they are equivalent, identical, and frequently that is not the case at all. Non-white people, victims of white supremacy, including Gus T, we have been exposed to this for years, this misbehavior, and many of us, we are still learning. We have not come to conclusions on some matters, and as such, we do not have logic. We will substitute, use a metaphor, and hope that that accurately conveys our thoughts. Often, it does not. It just adds to the confusion. If we could just speak explicitly, directly to what it is we want to say, that would be great. I will prompt about metaphors just for this broadcast. Thank you kindly. If you could take 5 minutes to share whatever questions, comments you have, suggestions, that would be great. Make sure everybody gets at least one chance to speak. Then if you have any additional thoughts you'd like to share, you can rejoin us once everyone has spoken at least once. Also, if you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button. Just helps to preserve the quality of the broadcast. Just whatever you need to say when you have your 5 minutes, and then mute. If you need to come back and share something or ask a question, you can unmute your line and share, but just makes it difficult when we have to speak over the television and echoing, that sort of thing happening in the background. I guess I will give out another reminder. Folks are interested. It's about a month away, or a little less than a month away. I do have to teach a full yoga class to graduate. So if you think you will be in the Seattle area, you can take a free class and you could wear your counter-racist t-shirt. If you have such an item in your closet, you could wear it to the yoga class. I would encourage you, wear it to the yoga class. I would really appreciate having more non-white people present in the class as opposed to having to teach my first class to a room of suspected racists. So in my view, it would be an exercise of counter-racism. If you are in the Washington State area or thinking of it, this is a lovely time to visit. It's been 80 degrees plus every day for the last 10 days. Sunny, absolutely gorgeous, no humidity. Just this is Seattle at its sparkling summer best. So if you want to come take a free class and practice some counter-racism, come take the class. I think it's August 19th. I will confirm date and time. I have not been told time myself, so once I find that out, I will let you know, but I'm pretty sure it's August 19th. Come visit Seattle, take a yoga class, a little counter-racism. With that, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. Oh, I think the switchboard is stalling again with the microphone, so it might take a few seconds as I open the... Oh, there we go. Okay, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey man, this Keith man, 713 man. I'm calling. I'm from Houston, man, but I'm calling from San Antonio. It probably lied because I'm at the transit center, right? But I was calling, man, because I had called in at the end of the last time you had Dr. Rashawn on there, Niana Rashawn, and I called in. Well, when I got on the line, I heard the lady Princess talking and whatever, right? And so I just really been, and see, like my mama, man, she is a real, you know, she in support of Bill Cosby get convicted and all this. But she, it kind of like, I won't put people into the mind that okay, in reality, see, females sell sex. You see what I'm saying? Sex is for sale when you're dealing with females, right? All right, now, and then when you look at that, and then you look at Bill Cosby, Bill O'Reilly, R. Kelly, whoever you want to put in, you mean to tell me you think these people is really out here forcing people to have sex? You know, and then she said something about the male is the main drama causer in the relationships. Man, I ain't never heard not one woman ever claim that a man lied on her, got her locked up, or did something. See, women do this type of thing. So, but she asked you, was she a feminist or something like that? But see, and then I know brothers get soft, but with the females on that level, because you know what I'm saying? Because like, you know, we keep trying to work together. So the male and the female relations is messed up, but it ain't gonna go nowhere with, like you say, pussyfooting around with these females about what they doing. Cause see, females they on that same level. They gain from the white lady, just like we got out from the white man. So it's both playing the same role. And then you know, and that's basically what I really wanted to say, man. Cause that was a wild interview, you know. But I've been noticing how. And you know what I'm saying? And like, I don't hate the sisters. You know what I'm saying? But I just like, well, you know, being for somebody that's out here, you know what I'm saying? I'll be 39 next Thursday. You know what I'm saying? On the second, man. And like, I've been out here and I ain't no fool. You know what I'm saying? Men's, okay, if some men sell sex, but women's sex is for sale, man. You know, so it like, so what you telling me, Bill Cosby, the main man on TV, a billionaire dollar man, and he out here raping, just forcing ladies. No, man, come on, man, it's too much money. Everything about money in this world, you know. So we trying to get the yoga, game up. We all trying to tap into the money. Hey, man, look, I went to see the Denzel movie. And I won't.
Oh, this is not. I make sure I get that in firm. We do not ever, from this point forward, I said this before, talk about movies. I do not care what anybody saw at the movie theater ever. Who there, if my mom was in the film, if I was in the film, I do not care. I'm not interested in hearing what anybody saw at the movies ever again. Did you have any other commentary, sir?
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to say discuss the movie. I walked out the movie. You know what I mean? But I was just thinking the reason why I brought it up is because, I mean, you know what I'm saying? People support you, Gus, and you support white people. So it ain't no, it really ain't no problem with supporting Denzel or any Black Panther in a movie, because it's still in the entertainment. If a nigga want to buy an R. Kelly CD, it's still Black people, all of us need our money in the system of white supremacy. Because you need your money.
30 seconds.
You still got to get your money through them. And with that, you can mute my line, bro. Hey, and thank you, man, and I love y'all, man. All right.
I've asked, I think, very courteously for years that I not be called brother, bro, any of the derivatives. Guess I have to continue with that effort as well. I guess I would say, one, I think there was a question asked in terms of, do people force individuals, female, male, to have sex? My answer to that is yes. I think the logic, the evidence, overwhelmingly, yes. People, lots of individuals are forced to have sexual intercourse. That's a major thing that happens under the system of white supremacy and all the time and has for years. That would be my answer to that question. I think it was stated that money, that's what makes the world go round, or some implication that that's the maximally important thing. I have concluded that that is not the case, that white supremacy, racism, that is the dominant force that trumps everything, finances, everything else on this here planet, at this time. I could be incorrect, but that is a major principle of this broadcast. As for the male-female relationships, males do not get along with anyone. Nothing about this planet promotes harmony with anyone. I am very tired of the whole male females don't get along thing. They don't and won't as long as the system of white supremacy exists. Nobody gets along. Minimize conflict as best we can. All of those discussions that just go around blaming one another for who did this and who didn't do that, I've just seen that it just produces a lot of conflict. It does not solve anything. Nobody likes it. That's why I said no brother, no sister. Let's just be honest about what we have. Solve the system of replace white supremacy with justice, and then we can work on having quality, healthy relationships and see about calling one another brother and sister and all that. I would appreciate it if we not reference black people as niggers on the program. When I do it, I'm speaking from the voice of racists. I do not just call black people niggers on the broadcast. I think that's black self-respect. Other folks we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed. The people that do have their lines open already are spectating, and then it's procrastinating a little bit as I open the other lines. Oh, okay. Now it is not procrastinating. Great. Folks who have a hand up, line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. Hello, everyone. This is Red in Nevada, and first thing, I listened to the Tuesday show. I listened to most of it, and it was I think it was a black male who was speaking about the T-shirt experiment. Definitely glad when he came to Las Vegas. Definitely glad he made it back to his home state, what have you, and hello to him. The first thing, just about a couple of the segments. The segment about the Professor Kathleen Buflu, I think Kathleen something, but she was speaking about the white supremacists and the first thing, I forgot, what is it, the Democracy Now! Clip, when they had asked her, basically, how does her research translate into contemporary events? And she was like, well, I can't really speak about that because it only goes, her research only went up to, and her book only went up to the Timothy McVeigh situation. And I feel like whites like to waste a lot of time reintroducing the same thing. There's been so many different documentaries. I even watched one documentary, and there's several about Timothy McVeigh, and not saying that, you know, you only need one documentary for everything, but if it's just going to it's just going to be regurgitating the same things, then why are you kind of wasting time? And I know it's more than just about Timothy McVeigh, but I felt like it might have been like an act of racism that she did not want to speak about basically the origins of where these hate groups are coming from and how they are showing themselves in today's society. I thought that was interesting. The other thing was that she kept referring to Klansmen and Nazis, like blatant white supremacists, as activists. And I guess maybe I just don't know, but it would have been nice to kind of understand her definition of activist, because my definition would be like someone who is trying to bring up good things or like make a positive effect on a group of people, whether it's racialized or economic or what have you. So, but I'm not seeing how like Nazis, and even she referenced even violent Nazis and violent white supremacists as activists. I thought that was definitely very interesting. She also used the term activism again when she referred to women and this whole thing of, oh, I really didn't know that white women were a part of this. I guess I'm kind of trying to make sure I don't get frustrated by that, because this is just, I feel like, one of their tactics to feign ignorance. It's like you cannot keep perpetuating an idea just through paternity alone. That it seems like impossible to me. you know, someone has to be teaching these children. It's, you know, the I feel like it has to be both sides, both men and female, to be teaching the children. But how the women, they would, you know, it really seemed like the Turner Diaries, like, you know, down to a T, you know, putting makeup on the people to go out and do violent acts. And that's when she said activism again. They used their activism to become like makeup artists and help write different things to help the men go out and commit violent acts. And I remember I did go back into the archives and I listened to the Turner Diaries and I laughed a lot during listening to it. It was quite funny to me, but I still tried to learn from it. Thought it was interesting, the NBC4 clip, that's an Ohio station, Columbus, Ohio, Central Ohio. That's Morris Road and 171. That's Northern Columbus. And it doesn't surprise me. I remember when I was a little girl walking downtown in Columbus with my grandmother, my sister, and my aunt. Just a car ran by, drove by, niggers, and just kept going. So doesn't surprise me. The homelessness clip, I thought it was interesting. When the journalist said that the Domes individual, the one, the researcher, he goes by pronouns of they and their. It's really getting ridiculous. And some people I know, they even go by it. I haven't ran into someone personally who went by it, but I remember just either different news clips or even like on television where they're like, no, I'm it. Like, not he, she, they, I'm it. So I thought that was interesting. And then also the Domes individual, when the journalist, when he was bringing out things about Black people that caused Black people to be homeless, Domes, he would say, well, people of color. We're not talking about people of color. We're talking about Black people. The last thing, I thought it was just about my continual research about the opioid epidemic. It's interesting how not only are they using their different states. I looked up the state, the representative Evan Jenkins out of he's a Republican out of West Virginia, and they're securing funds through Homeland Security. So it's not necessarily only through like, you know, how they'll say like public programs like welfare and stuff like that. No, they're also securing funds to help, quote unquote, combat the opioid epidemic through Homeland Security. It was gone through a bill that went through Tuesday on the 25th. I'm sorry, Wednesday, the 25th. It was Homeland Security Appropriations Bill. And they have, and it's for the fiscal year 2019. They're going to get $7.2 million from basically to help out their FEMA program. And this is all on the Jenkins person's page. And he was basically saying how they're going to basically use, they're going to get like $700 million through different programs under this Homeland Security to basically help combat the opioid epidemic. And so I'm like, you know what, they complain about not having enough money for other things, but they know how to secure money through different committees for the same thing, for the same basically welfare type of issues. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red. Mr. Fuller has talked about that frequently. Whites, they find money when they want to for whatever they choose to spend it on. If it's blowing up someone or fixing their quote-unquote drug problem, they will find the funds. Black homelessness, oh man, don't know. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we have not heard from you at all, proceed. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, everyone. I'm in full agreement with Ms. Red in saying that the white female has not been given enough credit for the culpability of their assistance and leadership in some cases of the global system of racist white supremacy. They are very instrumental. They are the basic teachers of the system of racism, white supremacy, because at one point in time, all of the males are under their direct supervision and care. It just so happens that that natural environment, they make the choice to practice racism on a base level, the white female does. And of course on all other levels also, but I mean, the level of from a baby to small children is automatic. What else? As a younger person, I used to read and study, you know, about the Olympics, and at the same time, and understand the Olympic Games, especially the Summer Games. You would connect the face of the athletes based on the quote-unquote country that they're from. And I was always kind of confused about when I would see Australia, knowing where Australia is located at, that you only see white people as far as the athletes in the Summer Games, track and field, so on and so forth. Another place that's called New Zealand, the same thing. I used to admire this white athlete by the name of Peter Snail. If you look him up, you'll see he was one of the world's best middle distance runners. White male wearing his black uniform from a place called New Zealand. And it kind of like confused me because I understood that even at that time that white people were from a place called Europe primarily. And of course, you know, from the standpoint of we know how white people got in this part of the world also. Then, of course, come to realize on how through their means to get out of that tiny abode that they caused tremendous amount of havoc and terror. In other words, wherever they went, and then, you know, they have basically had the same goal, which is terrorize and kill up a lot of the people that they see, non-white, and the ones that they allow to stay alive, they basically exploit and or force them to work for their best interests from that understanding. So I thought that clip was interesting. Last but not least, as far as the situation with my mom, she's back at the hospital. I won't necessarily talk about that. Other than from the standpoint in the workplace of the hospital, let's go back to white females right quick. Sitting in the room, you know, because all, you know, five of us, siblings, I mean, it's actually three that are down in South Florida right now. And we, you know, watch over, you know, mom and whatnot, that sort of thing, and assist when we can. And two white females, registered nurses, come into the room. And, you know, one kicks my foot. I say, excuse me. And a few seconds later, she kicks it again. And I say, excuse me again. I was on my way out. So basically after that second time, and she didn't say, you know, what normally people would say, you know, as far as if they have the intent to be polite, that sort of thing. But she went to try to, you know, grab my shoulder, to massage my shoulder. You know how people would put their hand on a person's shoulder and try to rub it to say something. And because I'm not a touchy-feely type of person, I'm very aware of that. So I was able to divert her by holding my hand in place of her hand where it was going and said, don't touch me. I can hear laughter on the other line, but don't touch me. And then I told my brother, I'm going to leave. I'll see you. I was leaving anyway, but, you know, as far as they're concerned, you know, just, you know, typical shenanigans white people do, you know. And I guess when I left, I had a talk with my brother, and he basically told me she basically was kind of like taking the victim role, so to speak. But no worries. I think the point was brought across, you know, to her. And that's all I'm saying right now. Thank you.
Taking the victim role. They are outstanding at doing that. Much obliged, retired firefighter. Was that Thomas in New York?
Yes, it was. Good evening. And I'm sorry to hear about retired firefighter's mother. I wish her the best. The hospital, the most racist place in America next to court, and I could attest to that. When I think of the heroin epidemic, when I go back, of course, in the black area, or the people classified as black in their area of town, they have, you know, we always had heroin. But when I was in high school, the person that was being promoted as a heroin addict was Kurt Cobain. So every time I think of heroin addicts, especially white heroin addicts, I for some reason Seattle just pops in my head. But they promoted it very strong in the 90s with him, in my opinion. All the photo shoots with him high and, you know, and white people that I went to school with, they were big fans of their music. So, you know, I think it goes back that far as far as the actual promotion. White women, that clip you played, very good, helping recruit, fighting the laws. And being married off to keep the peace between the racist families, very interesting. When I was in high school as well, they had a popular rap group called Wu-Tang Clan, and they had a song called Mystery of Chess Boxing. And when they the mystery of black homelessness, I was like, man, 40% of the U.S. homeless are black. And that's the same exact percentage, I believe, as prison. It's black, 40%, for people who only make up 12 to 13% of the population, according to the white people's statistics. I think that's astounding. Stand your ground. You know, man, as a people, I'm going to use a metaphor here. We have no ground to stand on, but white people can stand their ground, kill us at will. I watched that video maybe too many times just to see, you know, what he pushed him and he kind of stepped back. You know, to me, that's not standing your ground when you shoot someone. If they continue to come towards you, maybe. I think that law, of course, it's not going anywhere, but I think it needs to. I have a couple of things that I wanted to add in here. There was a white cop, a female cop, whose family member got into an argument with a Latino, a white-looking person that speaks Spanish. So a white person that speaks Spanish. This cop is a Italian white person. And she went to this person's house and kicked her in the stomach. She was 8 months pregnant. And she was arrested and fired. I thought that was very interesting because we get no justice. I don't see that happen if she kicked a black woman, you know, a person classified as black in the stomach. Also, two New Orleans cops were arrested and fired after beating a bar patron for questioning his nationality. This bar patron, another person that speaks Spanish, however, he can't pass for white at all. He was a native, a U.S. native, but he was raised in the Honduras and, you know, lives in New Orleans, served one tour of duty in Iraq in the Louisiana National Guard, was at a bar in New Orleans with the Army fatigue shirt, and some cops questioned if he was an American, why if he had that shirt on. He told them who he was. They didn't believe him, and they beat him up. And the pictures look very, very, very bad. And those cops were fired instantly. Once again, we don't get justice, but other people seem to. The last thing I wanted to talk about, another thing, Fortnite. It's this video game called Fortnite that my son plays. I find that it's become very, very, very popular. It has over 125 million people that play this game every day worldwide. And it's 100 people that get thrown into this island. You know, you fly, like a little craft flies you and you jump off with a parachute. And once you land, you have to go around and find weapons. And, you know, you have to be the last person, I believe, standing. But white supremacist organizations are using these to recruit. Because they have a chat room. And one of the things that stood out to me about the video game chat rooms that seems very suspicious is that the government has no way of encrypting, breaking through the encryption to track what those people are saying at all. So you have these huge recruitments. In fact, these white supremacists are in teams in the game killing off the non-white people. And before they have to kill each other and be the last man standing, they're practicing, in my opinion, codification, white codification, sticking together tactics and things. The very last thing I'm going to say, Gus, we can't allow white supremacist groups to march through the neighborhoods whites are allowing us to reside in without any show of resistance. That was set of precedents that I think led to a lot of black areas being burnt down in the early 1900s. Now, the white supremacist group that's being called the Oath Keepers were going to have a demonstration outside of Maxine Waters, an armed demonstration outside of her headquarters in South Los Angeles, which is, you know, South Central Watts. I think Inglewood is over there, Compton. It's a huge area where a lot of people live, and I think that the show of counter resistance was very prominent. They burnt the flag. I didn't think that was necessary, but what it did was it made the Oath Keepers cancel their demonstration. However, a lot of reports said that they ended up in Oakland, and that's where those girls got stabbed that night. And I wonder if they did it. They're not trying to look at that as a hate crime, which is terrible. Two black women get stabbed in the neck by a white man, and it's not looked at as a hate crime. I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Context of white supremacy. Other folks we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to Gus. Peace to everybody who is listening tonight. Peace also to the callers. This is V from Central New York. Not as busy as I've been the last few weeks when I've been listening. So my notes are a little bit more thorough. I actually only have a few things to cover. The idea of, what was it, gender confirmation surgery, which I've never in my life heard of, but I thought it was very interesting, and Gus, I think you pointed out that the idea of calling it that gave it a air of officialdom, because I've never heard that utilized, heard both of those words utilized in that manner, I automatically opened up my dictionary. And there was a statement made by the individual who went through the surgery where he said that he felt reborn. And thankfully, you pointed that out also, because that kind of really stayed with me as I was looking through the definitions. So beginning with confirmation, I'm looking in the Noah Webster's dictionary, the 1828 first edition. Beginning with confirmation, the standard definition of confirmation is the act of confirming or establishing. But that's not the interesting part. When you go down to the third definition, you get this definition. The act of giving new strength, as in the confirmation of health. Now, when I went to confirm, as a definition, the word confirm, they also spoke of this idea of giving strength. Where is it? Oh, I lost the page. That is okay. Number five, to strengthen, to ratify, as to confirm an agreement or a promise, a covenant, or a title. But number seven really speaks to the idea of being reborn, because it literally states this: to admit to the full privileges of a Christian. To admit to the full privileges of a Christian. I don't know if they knew this. I don't know if it was consciously scripted, but that's the seventh definition for the word confirm. The title People of Color, I am not a fan of that. I know on the show, everybody tends to refer to Black people as non-white. I think that's actually a good title. But People of Color, I think, actually reinforces racism, because if we are people of color, then who are people? Who is considered the general type of person or people? That would still be white people, because they are people of non-color. So that still gives them leverage in their system. And then finally, a good note. I was on the bus on my way to do some shopping, and this man who I had seen a few months ago gets on, bigger dude, bigger Black brother. We call each other brother, so that's why I call him brother. But so we start talking about health, because he notes that I'm losing weight. I'm starting to, you know, really look like my old self. And I told him that I was doing this new supplemental diet that a friend of mine recommended, and it was working wonders. And so him and I are talking about this, and this Black woman who had gotten on the bus along with him and had sat in the lower portion of the bus around a bunch of white people gets up, comes up with us, sits down, and starts talking about health with us. And we talked for about 20 minutes on what we all could do to make our health better, to make our bodies better, to make our minds better. And it was absolutely reinvigorating and re-strengthening for me. It is funny, when you start to really work on the problem of white supremacy, racism, white supremacy in your mind, and you really dedicate yourself to helping Black people and helping non-white people, not because you hate white people, but just because you know that is where the most need is, you have these kind of things happen, and I think we definitely need to highlight them more. Gus, thank you as always for the work that you are doing. Everybody have a great night.
That is wonderful. I'm envious. I'm glad you had that experience, V. I think Mr. Fuller, on one of his many visits on this year broadcast, The Context of White Supremacy, he said that he was referencing a song that I certainly don't know and therefore can't sing, Celebration. But he was saying basically that you will get assistance, but only in the direction that you're headed. So he gave these specific illustrations. If you are, we'll say heroin, since that's the white drug of choice for the evening, you're selling heroin, well, then you might get help in selling heroin and become, you know, a huge heroin kingpin. If you are trying to replace white supremacy with justice, or trying to work on losing weight, improving your mental, spiritual, physical health, get help with that. Just depends on what are you focusing your time and energy. He talked about that explicitly, just saying that I think he was even being a little metaphysical, as they say, and saying that something about the universe, just there is a inertia. If you are tending to move in a constructive direction, then that'll be more of the assistance that you get. If you're into non-constructive things, well, that'll be more of what you tend to get. You can ponder on it, see if it makes any sense, or you could go back in the archives and hear where he describes that specifically. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments and definitions, so important. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, if we've not heard from you, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Ivy.
Oh, sorry. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Gus, I wanted to ask you, on the things any racists say, you played the video from Destiny. You played it, the audio, rather, 4 minutes of it. Do you think that that was probably the broadcast?
Do I think that was probably the broadcast?
Meaning, do you think that that was probably the broadcast where you played the full audio?
Where it was 4 minutes?
Yes, you played 4 minutes of it on that broadcast.
I played 4 minutes. Did it sound like that was the video? I'm just confused. It was 4 minutes. What was the video that you heard, or the audio segment that was 4 minutes?
Of Destiny's video of things any racist or things that white activists say to activists of color.
Mm-hmm. So you heard a 4 minute, I guess, segment of audio, Destiny's video. She was a former guest on the program. Things white activists say to act. There's that word again, to activists of color. You heard a 4 minute segment of that on the program?
Yes.
Okay. Then that was it. I'm certain that that was it. And that was it in its entirety. I'm sure I didn't edit it or cut it down or subtract or, you know, do anything to molest the audio. That was what she had online. It was short. It wasn't anything really, you know, lengthy. What she had on, I think it was Vimeo, was where she had it posted.
Yes. Okay, well then that's great, because that ultimately means that I'll found it, and you know, you don't have to look for it or anything. Yes, and I appreciate you even being willing to look for it. But what I wanted to say was, you know, you've heard it said many times that, you know, to solve this problem of white supremacy, it's going to take 1,000 years, 500 years, 2,000, just, you know, a really long time. And I don't think that's true. I think that this problem can be solved within our lifetime, if not sooner, meaning by the end of our lives, if not sooner, depending on how long we stay here, because as we've talked about, it just seems that the major problem is confusion. I wish that we, especially as Black people, that we reacted to all other forms of terrorism and racism the way we react to the word nigger. And I understand why we don't, because around the word nigger, we have clarity, a lot of clarity. We understand that the racism and the terrorism is intentional and all of that, whereas when it comes to denying us jobs and all these other forms of terrorism, even murdering us on videotape, we don't believe that it's intentional. We believe them when they say that they fear for their lives and all this and that, but you know, we have clarity around that word. And so what I wanted to do, what your program has inspired me to do, is just to the types of confusion that I see, because the two types of confusion I see is that we don't see white people as racist, and we don't believe that what they are doing, that they mean to do it. And that I was just going to try to, whether it be online or just talking to people, do whatever I can to expose the truth behind that and show and give examples of where there can be clarity around those things. So to whether if it's online, for an example, I can post broadcasts of your program where people that would be not suspected as racist are shown to practice racism and even admit that they are racist, like anti-racist, like religious people, like children, you know, just people that are not usually suspected. And I'm also going to think about how I can, you know, whether it be a podcast or a blog or just something where I can just disseminate information that exposes the things that we are talking about, that exposes that it's intentional and exposes that white people are racist and that the vast majority, if not all of them, are. Because in terms of the last thing that I wanted to say, in terms of how I think that this problem can be solved by the end of our lives, if not sooner, is that I think of that anti-racist, things anti-racists say, that video that Destiny made and how white people made her take it down, which is what I believe is what happened, because that video went viral. I don't know how many views she got. I just know she said on the program that it went viral. And in that situation, what she was able to do is show, I don't know how many people, that white so-called activists are racist. And that is really bad for their system, because it reveals truth and it brings clarity of people that you didn't think was racist. And now you're able to, just in an instant, you could probably like give that clarity to a million people in one day, just from videos or anything else just going viral. And so with the technology that we have today and how we can get information out so quickly, I think that that can be really used to help to lessen confusion in a very short amount of time. And I think that that is how we can solve this problem very, very soon. It's just to eliminate the confusion or lessen the confusion really quickly. And that's all I wanted to say, at least for now. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Context of white supremacy. Much obliged. Ivy, that was way back when. I think even some listeners dialed in when Destiny was on that program and offered to purchase her, and I think did. They followed through. They didn't just make the offer, purchase her Dr. Welsing's book, Mr. Fuller. I think even Yorugu, Dr. Marimba Ani, to get her some literature to help eliminate or reduce confusion. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. Oh, wait a minute. I had a quick question before. Did anybody hear me say that I would post the link to the new Purge film, the one that came out, I guess, a couple days ago? Did anyone hear me say that on a podcast at any time, that I would post a link to that film?
I didn't hear it.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. I don't remember saying that, but if anyone recalls that I did say that, I will honor that request. But I don't think I said that, and if no one can call me on it, I am not going to, because I am certainly not trying to encourage that anybody watch that. So if anybody did hear me say that, and you can, oh yeah, you said that on, you know, this past broadcast or whenever, I will honor the request. But I don't think I said that. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Caller in Florida.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I know they were talking about the Stand Your Ground. And with that situation, I just think it's very terroristic in an act of racism that they're showing that footage on television. The actual raw surveillance footage, black person being shot, executed, you know, not even pixelating it. It is just something about that. I think you've made commentary on that, Gus, about how that can affect the mind of victims, non-white people. And it'll be interesting to see how that ends up being examined by the news media. And the segment about the metaphor where the guy was saying he has a thick skin, and that the sick kids don't have thick skin. And, you know, I'm wondering that as well. Like, what does that mean? Is that
caller in Florida? Are you still there? Caller in Florida, you still with us, sir? Not hearing you. Not sure if he got disconnected. He was talking about the attorney general's, state attorney general in New Jersey, his metaphor about the thick skin. And then I did not hear him. I'm not sure if he got disconnected. I will look on the switchboard to see if he dials back in, or I don't know if he tapped his mute button by accident either. But we're not hearing you, caller in Florida. If you want to hang up, dial back in, I will unmute your line and you can resume your commentary while we are waiting to figure out what happened with his line. Are there any other folks that we missed totally? If you have a hand up and we've not heard from you at all, line should be open. Proceed.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Drayton Mania. Gus, I was listening to your program where you did, I think that you did on Tuesday about the yoga class, and you were talking about the Purge movie, and I thought that you said that you had it. It was posted on the blog talk program. I thought that I heard you say it on that program, that link was posted on, that you watched the movie for free online, and that you had it, or that it was posted on a blog talk. And I was wondering if you knew if you had the link for that for the Purge movie.
I did watch it online for free, as I said, on the program. But I think what I referenced was, we talked about the Purge with Dr. Martin Kevorkian, admitted white supremacist, what we talked about earlier, and that the broadcast where we talked about the Purge was linked in the description. I think that's what it was, not the actual film, because I know certainly, and I mean, that is certainly not a film that I would in any way want to promote or encourage people to watch in terms of an investment. I would feel some sort of culpability that someone invested 90 minutes or whatever it is of their time and energy under these conditions, particularly a black person, into that content. Like, yeah, it's woof.
Wow. I mean, I can understand, and mainly the only time I watch films is when I watch them free online also, so I usually don't spend my money on movies. But also, in regards to the commentary for tonight, I just thought it was very interesting how, you know, like, you know, you just reiterating what was said, how they can find all this money for, you know, nonsense, like, you know, with confirmation, reassignment, whatever it's called, surgeries. You have people that need transplants, kidney transplants, heart transplants, like surgeries that where people really need these surgeries. And this is something that you're opting to get, and it's voluntary, but we're paying for this money, you know, paying for this out of our taxpayers' dollars. They always seem to have such a problem with, you know, knowing where the money is going. But yeah, still, we're supposed to, like, feel some type of concern about this guy, whatever it, he, she, whatever you want to call it, getting this reassignment type of surgery. And it's just totally amazing, you know. And that's all I have to share. I was just basically listening, but I just wanted to get some clarity on the whole Purge link. And I do apologize for misunderstanding, and thank you for the clarity. Now I'll mute my line.
No apologies needed at all. Reading is more important than watching television or going to the movies. Any other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Proceed. Oh, I think we got our caller in Florida back. We'll see. If you're with us, sir, I think we lost you. You were talking about the state attorney general in New Jersey and the metaphor thick-skinned, that you didn't understand what he meant when he said that. I think that's where we lost you.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, I remember hearing that part. And I remember he was going into talking about the travel ban, I believe, and he was using the term the families being separated. I think that's also going into that concept that I was thinking about, how people would say the news media, they tend to focus on certain select non-white groups to make a report on. And when it comes to Black people, definitely we are affected the most various ways. And I think what's put into that as well is these different non-white groups are also mistreated in various ways. And I was just really just giving that thought. And I also wanted to make a comment on the word feel, F-E-E-L. Like, I noticed that term, like, that was used against me by suspected white supremacists. They was trying to say, well, this is how you feel about something, when it's them, they are the ones initiating this racist, crafty behavior. I'm responding to it. So how is it something that I feel, or something that Black people feel? Like, I'm not saying people shouldn't use the word feel, but I think the racists try to utilize that word in a very deceitful way to make it seem like it's something Black people just think or just have a certain emotion about, and it's not a reality. And that's the only thing that I have right now. And thanks for allowing me to share.
I agree. Skillful use of terms. It's similar to workplace racism. When they'll say you have a grievance or a gripe, as though, you're just a little child with sensitive feelings. That's the way that they try to project Black people who are making a legitimate report about being terrorized. They will skillfully use language. No one does it better to totally minimize and invalidate. It's the exact opposite. Confirmation surgery with Black people. See, this is how you feel about being homeless for the last 3 years and us being confounded by the mystery of your homelessness. Sorry you feel that way. Very, very skillful with their use of words. You can just be mindful of that on a regular basis. That's that whole spectrum. You feel this way, or you racially insensitive comments. They won't say that someone was racist. They were racially insensitive. They have a variety of different ways of using words that all they're accomplishing the same goal. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for taking my call. Hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. Just some reminders, I guess general reminders about talking about these issues with non-white Black people. There was one I was talking with my mother. She watches this show, The View. There was an incident, I believe, last week between a white lady and the Black moderator, Whoopi Goldberg. The white lady said her part. Whoopi Goldberg said her part. And so my mother, we were talking about it, and I said, well, there's another white lady there who claims to be a white ally. I don't understand why she just didn't say, yes, I saw it too. I agree with the Black person. If the Black person, was telling the truth, and I was trying to tell her, they have a code about themselves, white people, that no matter what wrong they do, they're not going to tell on each other. We had a big, argument about it, so on and so forth. So, I mean, she's still my mother. We talk every day. It didn't stop the relationship. But just be mindful of those things, because I was narrow-minded and short-sighted, and, what if the little white girl lost her job and all of this? I was like, okay, whatever. And then I had another incident last week where I went to a community meeting, and they were talking about racial inequities in various areas. So I went to ask about, who are these races that are involved and these inequities, and they said black, brown, and Asian people. And I was like, well, didn't the Japanese get their reparations? You know, don't they have things settled and this and the other? And they said, well, we want to help all people of color. And I'm like, well, Asian people usually have their own community where they, usually in every city, I see they are able to get their own community, you know, brown people. I said, I don't know who these brown people are. I said, because if you go to the U.S. Census, the race is black and not brown. Hispanic people, it clearly says they are not a race. So I don't know who these people are. And I told myself, frankly, I'm here to help the black people. I don't think they were very glad about that, especially because maybe because they were two white people in the audience of mostly black people. But I said that in front of them because I was like, this is what I'm here for, to help black people. So no disrespect to the other groups. I'm black. Black people need help. Then they went on to tell me how black people did the other black people wrong in Atlanta, this and the other, forgetting that the governor of Georgia is also in Atlanta. That person is white. They may have something to do with that. But I didn't go on to argue with them. You know, I've only lived here a couple of years, this, that, and the other. So just be mindful of these things when you are trying to bring some clarity about an issue or just inquire that you are going to get the pushback. Be ready for it. You know, you don't have to be upset. Just go, okay, these people don't understand, or we have a difference of opinion, VGQ, and move on. You don't have to cry about it, feel bad. Oh, these are awful people. You're just in different places. I was at a point where I didn't understand as well. Thank you.
Wow, that is great. Something we should all remember. At one point, I was confused myself, still am, but was even more confused. That is definitely something to remember. I don't think anyone here can truthfully say that at the time they were born, they had a thorough, comprehensive understanding of counter-racism and its concepts, application. They had that upon arrival. I don't think any of us can truthfully say that. So we are all still learning. Great to keep in mind. Yeah. Other folks that we have not heard from at all. And I did want to also make a point when I have requested for years that I not be called brother. The minor conflict that you talked about just with discussing exchange of views with your mother. Now, that's between a mother and her offspring. Now, once it moves to total strangers, wow, I have seen where that, you know, minor conflict, it can be much, much greater, much worse, I'll put it that way, than you are short-sighted, where it can get really, really brutal and discourteous when it's an exchange of views. So that VGQ is very important. In my view, much more important and much more effective than just brother and sister, because I have seen where that can degrade really quick from brother and sister, or that brother's a coon. I have seen and heard that too many times in this here lifetime. Other folks who dialed in, anybody that we missed completely that has a hand up? Let's see, Mr. Steele, did you have commentary, sir? You should be with us. Are you still stuck in Iowa? Not hearing him. Not sure if he's in a place where he can speak. Not able to hear you, Mr. Steele. We'll check in with him later. Software developer, Wisconsin, did you have commentary?
Yes, sir. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the listeners and callers. Two things. One, the transgendered person, I know quite a few non-white transgendered females. My sibling who was born my brother is one. So, and I have noticed that amongst non-white black transgendered females, there tends to be a, first of all, can you hear me really well? 'Cause I just started talking.
Oh, yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. there tends to be among non-white, non-white black transgendered females, there tends to be a reticence to getting the surgery. And I've noticed this amongst non-white, non-black transgendered people as well. It's led me to a theory where I think that my brother or sister, whatever you want to say, is dressing as a female because he finds he believes that being a black female is better than being a black male due to the system of racism, white supremacy. My mother and I were discussing this actually earlier today, and he tends to be very masculine. He tends to have to force himself to be feminine. He isn't a gay male, so or he was a gay male, now transgender female. But he tends to be very masculine. He's very reticent towards getting the surgery, and he wants to be buried in a three-piece suit when he passes. So and that seems to be a trend. This trend of getting surgery seems to be relegated to white people. I really have never heard transgender black females, and I know at least 10 due to my brother, and I've never heard them say anything about getting their penises removed. So that's something to keep in mind with that. Also, I really haven't seen any mistreatment of white transgendered females, only non-white transgendered females, including a transgender female I know who was shot and killed by a white male. So that's something else to keep in mind. As far as BTQ and speaking about things to other victims, I was actually in a situation yesterday where my son's father came over to my house, and he doesn't drive. He rides the bus. So I took him and my son back to his house, and I asked him if he was going to take his son next Saturday, because I was going to this knitting conference and I was going to wear my counter-racist T-shirt. And he said, no, I don't want him to go with you, especially if you're going to wear that shirt. I am going to take him. And I said, okay. And he said, you know, you're just looking for trouble. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, you know, it's racist, that shirt. And I said, well, why is it, how is it racist? Well, I mean, I don't want to be treated like white people. I said, well, are you mistreated? And he said, well, yes, I'm mistreated all the time, at work, all the time. And I said, well, do you think white people are mistreated? He said, well, some are. I said, well, who are these white people who are being mistreated? And he couldn't answer. And in fact, he said, I don't want to speak about it anymore, but that's racist. You know, you're being racist. And so we're driving down the street, and there is appears to be a white female in a dress with a skateboard over her shoulder. And he says, oh, wow, she's skateboarding with a dress on. And then he looks at her and he says, oh, and excuse my language, he says, oh, that's just a funky hunky. And I said, do you think that was racist? And he said, oh, no, I don't think that was racist. I said, exactly. And that was it. With that, I will mute my line. Thanks very much.
Wow. If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is and how it works, everything else will only confuse you. Neely Fuller Jr., victim of racism. Great job asking questions. That can also be very effective with some victims. Now, you do have to make an assessment. Sometimes they're victims of racism who do get upset about being asked questions, and they might get an attitude. They won't answer your question. They, you know, will take it. They will become offended somehow with being asked the question. But if you have someone who, you know, they're willing, they see that you're not, you know, having an attitude or what have you, that you're asking a question and willing to patiently, you know, wait for them to answer, that can be effective too. But that sounds like exactly what you invoked, just asking questions to reveal truth. And you can also gauge when you have a victim of white supremacy. For many of us, accepting the truth about our pitiful condition and our terrifying position being victims of white supremacy, that can be a bit much. Dr. Welsing, she used to talk all the time about her job as a physician, third generation physician, clinical psychiatrist, her job to help patients accept the truth, even when they are reluctant to do so. And the system of white supremacy, white terrorism, has made many of us very reluctant to accepting, acknowledging, talking truthfully about racism. Whole time I was thinking when you were discussing too, definition for racism. If I'm going to be accused of having a racist garment, what is your definition of racism? That ends a whole lot of gripes, arguments, complaints, ding, come to a complete halt. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, should be with us. Anybody that we missed completely? Grand. I will assume we nabbed everyone. Mr. Steele, did you have commentary? He might not be in an area still where he's able to speak. Anyway, we will look out if you are able to chime in the next 20 minutes before the broadcast concludes. That would be great. Anybody have other commentary that they wanted to share, even if you've already spoken once?
Can I be heard?
Let's see. We'll do.
I'll go after you.
Draftomania. Thank you kindly for yielding, Red.
Hi, Gus. I just wanted to let you know I posted something on your page on Facebook. It was about a story about this white supremacist that befriended a black woman. I forget where it was at, and he befriended her and he murdered her. So when you get an opportunity, could you look at the post that I posted on your page?
Yes, ma'am.
And it's basically just reiterating what you keep telling us about, like, having white friends. And this guy did purposely would befriend black people, but he was a white supremacist, and he ended up murdering this black woman. So that's all I wanted to share.
That was Jeffrey Dahmer. That's just one illustration. But, I mean, Mr. Fuller did say that that is the prototype, that would be the best illustration, of a white supremacist. To befriend them, take them home, make them a sandwich. There's many documentaries, but they even have one where there's a black female. She said that Dahmer, she was his neighbor. She said that she used to go and they would eat meals together. She said, you know, it's given her all kinds of trauma, thinking that she might have been fed, you know, body parts or what have you. But he used to cook for her and they would have a grand old time hanging out. And he's exclusively terrorizing and cannibalizing non-white, mostly non-white children, non-white and black children, Mr. Dom, in the great state of Wisconsin. But that's standard operating procedure. Racists, they are phenomenal. And particularly when you have victims, that's what I've been saying the whole time about the underlying principle of the T-shirt, especially when it's victims that they can see, oh yeah, this person is very confused. They don't suspect me at all. Oh, they love that. Non-white people that are extremely confused about racism, white supremacy. Let's pick this one out. This is a great victim. We talked about that, all of that extensively with Jeffrey Dahmer, The Wisdom of Psychopaths.
Right. And I'm just so glad I'm not confused like I used to be, because I was confused at one point. And when I read that article, I'm so grateful I am less confused than I was. But I'm still confused, but not confused in that area any longer. And now I'll mute my line. And thank you, guys.
Yes, ma'am. Brett in Nevada, did you want to share?
Yes, thank you for allowing me to speak again. I know sometimes I've been told that I speak really fast because I don't want to go over the 5 minutes, but when I was sharing my commentary just about the West Virginian House of Representative, the money that I was speaking about, like the $7.2 billion and the $750 million, that's only for his state. And so it just really, I've been really trying to kind of grasp the whole gravity of how much money racists can get for one state, for one small problem versus, you know, like what you were saying and like what a lot of people say, you know, there's so many different things going on in other states that they might not even need, you know, $7.2 million. I understand that that was for FEMA, but it's like if you can, and I was thinking about, you know, if the president calls a, what is it, the state of emergency, and then can like enact FEMA, then, you know, that's money that they can use. And then also just how it kind of then can help also support other white people, because some of the money would go towards firefighters. And I know there have been several segments played, and then also from the retired firefighter, how just all so much racism within the, you know, the fire department. Some of the money, some of that $750 million was going towards, you know, staffing and stuff like that. So it just kind of really is just kind of, to me, it's helping me to understand how it's a constant way for white people to not only transfer wealth back to them for their needs, but even to stop any type of black people from accumulating wealth because through the taxes. So that's all I wanted to add to that. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. Mr. Steele, were you in a space where you could share yet? Perhaps he is not. I will check in again to see if we can get his commentary before we get ready to conclude. I had a question for folks that are here. Is it a part of your counter-racist code that you do not, what they call date, engage in any sort of sexual activity with another non-white person that you know is already involved in some sort of sexual arrangement with another non-white person? Like, is that a part of people's counter-racist code? Yay, nay. And you can explain why yes or no. If you want to abstain, that's fine. You can just be solid. But is that an established part of people's counter-racist code?
Hello?
Can I be heard?
We'll get our female caller first.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks,
thank you. Are you asking about adultery? I mean, get to the point, because that was kind of confusing.
But no.
If someone's dating,
go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Because I didn't understand that. You said the same word like several times. Could you repeat that, please?
If the person is involved sexually with somebody else, is it a part of your code that, okay, I cannot... there cannot be any sort of sexual activity with this person because they already have an arrangement with somebody else. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. No, you don't do that.
Okay.
That's correct. If you let them finish. I don't do separations. Get a divorce. Clean breaks. Ooh, that's just... No. Too confusing. Health issues. That's me, most important, health issues. You're not going to kill me behind somebody else. I'm not the one for that. I don't know about other people, but no, you're not going to try to kill me from body other fluids or whatever. No.
Gotcha. Much obliged. V in New York, was that you were going to respond?
Absolutely. That, and you actually reminded me of something, but no, that's in all circumstances, no. Years ago, when I was very confused, I did engage in a relationship with a person who said they were in the process of getting divorced. I later on found out that that was far from the truth. There was no divorce being discussed. They were, in fact, involved in a very loving relationship. And so, yeah, that's no. And I tell that to everybody. Don't do that. And you reminded me when I hear transgender, when I hear gender reassignment, I always think about Yorugu and the idea of just the mass confusion that is white people, which is so evident. Not confusion. No. That's the wrong word. The incompleteness that is white people and embedded into their culture spreads to everybody else and manifests as confusion, So it almost is as if they're trying to escape from themselves with all of this idea of gender reassignment and transracialism, transhumanism. They're not happy with themselves. And so I always remember that. So, but yeah, to your question, no. Thank you very much again.
Much obliged to be. Yes, ma'am.
I guess my take on it is that I feel like it's kind of generational if for that question, because I know that I've noticed that I'm under 30, but like with the people who are around my same age, they won't even tell you. And it's not even something to where it's like kind of what you're describing kind of to me kind of seems like monogamy. And that's just something that I feel like the white supremacists, and it always goes back to them, have really perpetuated with the younger black people to not be monogamous. So you either, you know, just be happy for the time that you're spending with that person, and then they get to go off and do whatever they want. Personally, I'm with.
Hello?
Oh, I can hear you. Red, are you still there? Red, are you still with us? She might have got disconnected. That's interesting. That would be two different people that got disconnected while they were talking. Red and our caller in Florida. If you're still there, Red, are you still there? Not hearing you. I'll be on the lookout. If you can hear us, Red, we're not hearing you. If you want to just hang up and dial back in, I'll look for you on the switchboard and bring you back in. While we're waiting, Thomas in New York, were you going to comment, sir?
Yes. What the gentleman just spoke about, man, see that what they're pushing with all of this homosexual LGBT infidelity, the end game for white supremacy is transhumanism. That's what they're trying to usher in. And everything they're doing, the massive tattoos, the face tattoos, this is all trying to promote transhumanism, which will be when white people want to have a fake arm, they go and get a prosthetic arm, have their real arm cut off, even though nothing's wrong with it, or their leg, or put a bionic leg. You know, that's where they're headed to. That's their end game. The infidelity is in the black community, the people that's being classified as black, their community. The infidelity is being promoted heavily in the hip-hop songs. If you listen to the modern-day rap songs, no one has a girlfriend. No one has a wife. And the only people they have sex with is whoever they're talking about, you know, girlfriend or wife. You know, I had his girl doing this. I had her one, you know. It's never their own. It's always someone else's. And I just think that's very interesting that they're promoting that. It's almost like a rite of passage that, you know, you have to go get someone else's girl, not your own. You know, it's being promoted heavily through the white supremacist entertainment industry.
Confusion. I'm trying to see if we have Red back with us as it's the program. Oh, okay. Let's see if she's... Red, are you back with us? Got disconnected. You were talking about generational thing.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I looked at my phone and it died. It was crazy. Or not died, but the phone dropped, or the call dropped or whatever. But no, I feel like it's definitely what Thomas in New York said. I see it a lot with it's generational. I definitely would not agree with something like that just because of all the different diseases, and even hearing black people around me saying, well, they're not even afraid of the diseases anymore because they can basically cure it. So that would definitely be my take. I know a female caller, she had said that, you know, there are many different, you don't know who their partner is, you know, being with or whatever, but I would say no. But then again, there's also comes a time, just like with V said, people aren't really even telling you. It's like, you better be happy for whatever time that you have with that person and don't worry about what they do when you're not around. So that's just what I have observed. Thank you. Now I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Red. Any other commentary last few moments before we conclude?
What Red said, that was compelling. Another thing that they ushering in through their, I'm noticing through the entertainment industry is unprotected sex. One of the biggest female artists, who was a stripper before she became a rapper, Cardi B, talks about how she don't like condoms. You know, she never used them. You know, pretty much a lot of people are saying that, you know, the disease known as AIDS, and that it just sort of jumped off the scene. You know, white people can push the button and put it right back out to it anytime they want to. So it's almost like the lessons learned from the generation before, the next generation, they set it up where they get those lessons, and then the generation after will get hit with those, you know, same thing. It's the same trend they constantly play. It's just another STD with another name. That's going to do it. But the fact that I've heard several artists in their songs promoting non-safe sex, I thought was very interesting. Especially since, you know, in my generation, we had people like Left Eye with the condom in her glasses, and it was really heavily promoted. And people were dying, and it's just like gone.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Check one more time. Mr. Steele, did you have a commentary you wanted to get in if you are with us? Last few moments before we get ready to wrap up. Might have to wait until next week to hear from Mr. Steele. Don't know if he's still struggling in Iowa. The reason I asked that question, we should be heading towards trying to minimize confusion. I think conflict between non-white people, certainly it has, it came up this evening, but that is something that, you know, gets discussed regularly in dialogue about white supremacy, racism, and it is a major, major problem. Anything that we can do to minimize conflict with one another, I definitely think we should attempted counter-racists. We should be in the business of trying to minimize as much confusion and potential conflict between other non-white people. I think that should definitely be evident in how we function in all areas of people activity. Other folks?
Can I bear it?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Yes, it's, the question kind of brought up thought of mine. With comparison, I don't know the name of this white female who has lately been at least in the national news about her going back to absorb drugs, and it's been like a national sorrow and sympathy for her. I haven't heard anything negative in her connection with her reintroducing herself to drug use. She actually is making money off of it with this song that's expressing it. But nevertheless, the great singer Whitney Houston was trashed continuously for her drug problems. Didn't anybody make an observation of similar to that? I was just wondering.
I saw that online. Comments about that online.
Okay, similar to what I just
finished. Yes, her treatment versus this junkie's treatment versus Whitney Houston's treatment.
Okay, because I didn't even read it, but I just thought about it. I just thought about it when Gus brought up the question. For some reason, I just thought about it, and just made that contrast. I mean, I literally haven't heard anything negative about this white female that obviously has been absorbing narcotics for a long time in her life. Nothing about, you know, where she's getting it from, her connections, anything. As I mentioned before, she actually is using it to make more money, because obviously if she just cut a a recording for her drug use, her additional drug use. Somebody's buying it. Somebody's buying whatever, however they do sales now, as far as that concerns. And I'm not expecting anything different. I'm just making the observation. I would say to the question, Gus, that under a global system of racist white supremacy, non-white people have problems enough with a intimate relationship with one person, let alone talking about. I would say if it's problems with the one person, and then if you're talking about adding on, you're going to have multiple people that's bound to get mistreated in that process. We do not do well together under a global system of race and white supremacy. And I agree with Mr. Fuller, it's never going to be right as long as there's a global system of racism and white supremacy. The only thing that we can do under these circumstances is make arrangements on, Beverly, this is what I'm not going to do to you. I'm not going to shoot you to death. I'm not going to beat you up when I get mad at you, you know, things of that nature. We can make those type of decorations to each other on what we're not going to do under these circumstances, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Indeed. Great point, retired firefighter. I heard a report where they were talking about her history of declaring her what they call substance abuse issues, this white woman, Demi Lovato. Not sure if that's how you say her name. I don't track every white drug addicted starlet. But they were talking about her history of having done this and how she made a big song about her alcohol problem and throwing up in the back of somebody's car and all of this. And it's way more courteous, dignified treatment than what I've heard many black. In fact, way better treatment than even the deceased Nia Wilson was afforded. They had a big to-do in California reporting suspected white supremacist activity where they were posting pictures. This is the 18-year-old who was stabbed at the BART station in California, where they were posting photographs of her allegedly holding a firearm of some sort. It's the, oh my goodness, another thug nigra who was probably out looking to loot BART riders. Maybe it might be good that, you know, she's no longer with us, that those were the photos that they chose to post of her system of white supremacy once again. With that, we will call it a broadcast. Thanks to everyone for participating. I hope it's been a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. We will be back. You can check Black Talk Radio Network, the Facebook page. Again, the iTunes content archives should be current. This broadcast should be posted within half hour or so. Just wait for it to refresh. But thankfully, it looks like that problem has been solved, at least for the next few minutes or so. If you have any questions, problems, guest suggestions, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. The next book for the book club is Zora Neale Hurston, Barracoon. Was just published this year, just a few weeks ago. In fact, very, very recently. We'll be starting it this coming Friday. With that, email again, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks for all participants, listeners, archive listeners, active callers, hoot fearing from everyone. I will suggest again, I know it's summertime and folks are getting out. I heard some people say they have quote unquote birthdays coming up. Have fun, enjoy the sun, but remain codified. Race soldiers do not take holidays or pause just because there is a little more sunshine at this particular point, or because there's an eclipse or a buck moon, as they say. They do not pause for any of those occurrences. We need to remain codified at all times. In my view, that would mean sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Dr. Welsing, many of the folks that we esteem would strongly encourage that we are sober so that we can protect our health and make phenomenal decisions to try to keep ourselves as safe as we can under conditions of terrorism. In addition to being sober, if we're going to be in a vehicle, we should be buckled up every time, driver or passenger. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.